Blog Talk Radio.
Bucka, 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 bucka. Ha ha. You know the deal. Hey, dope. Beats by Supremo for all of my people, Negroes and Latinos, and even the gringos. Yo, check it, one for Charlie Hustle, two for Steady Rock, three for the four, coming live, future shock. It's five dimensions, six senses, seven firmaments of heaven to hell, 8 million stories to tell, nine planets faithfully keep in orbit with the probable tenth. The universe expands length, the body of my text possess extra strength, power lifted, powerless, up out of this towering inferno. My ink so hot it burns through the journal, I'm blacker than midnight on Broadway at Myrtle. Hip hop past all your tall social hurdles, like the nationwide projects, prison industry complex, working class poor, better keep your alarm set. Streets too loud to ever hear freedom ring, say it back in with your sleep. It's dangerous to dream, but your chain cats hit, they your back, you dead now. Killing fields need blood to graze the cash cow. Numbers game, but shit don't add up somehow. Like I got 16 to 32 bars to rock it, but only 15% of profits ever seen my pockets. Like 69 billion in the last 20 years spent on national defense, but folks still live in fear. Like nearly half of America's largest cities is one quarter black. That's why they gave Ricky Ross all the crap. 16 ounces to a pound, 20 more to a key. A 5 minute sentence here and then you're no longer free. 40% of Americans own a cell phone, so they can hear everything that you say when you ain't home. I guess Michael Jackson was right. You were not alone. Rock your hard hat black as you in the terror dome. Full of hard niggas, large niggas, dice tumblers, young teens in prison greens facing life numbers, crack mothers, crack babies, and AIDS patients. Young blood can't spell, but they can rock you a PlayStation. New math is whipping motherfuckers' ass. You wanna know how to rhyme? You better learn how to add. It's mathematics.
Mighty most desperate.
It's simple mathematics. Check it out. I revolve around China.
What are we talking about here? Mighty most deaf.
It's simple mathematics. Check it out. I revolve around China.
What are we talking about here?
But two sides to every story, three strikes and you bitten for life, mandatory. Four MCs murdered in the last 4 years. I ain't trying to be the fifth when the millennium is here. Yo, it's 6 million ways to die from the seven deadly thrills. 80-year-olds getting found with 9 mils. It's 10 p.m. where you see that. What's the deal? They on the hill pumping krills to keep their bellies filled. Lighting the ass with heavy steel. Sights on the pretty shit in life. Young soldiers trying to earn their next strike. When the average minimum wage is 5.15, you best believe you gotta find a new grind to get cream. The white unemployment rate is nearly more than triple for black. Frontliners got their gun in your back, bubble and crack, jewel theft and robbery to combat poverty and end up in the global jail economy. Different stipulations attached to each sentence. Budget cutbacks but increased police presence. And even if you get out of prison, still living, join the other 5 million under state supervision. This is business. No faces, just lines and statistics. From your phone, your zip code to SSI digits. The system break man channeling women in the figures. Two columns for who is and who ain't niggas. Numbers is hard and real and they never have feelings. But you push too hard, even numbers got limits. Why did one straw break the camel's back? Here's the secret. The million other straws underneath it. It's all mathematics.
Mighty most deaf.
It's simple mathematics. Check it out. I revolve around science.
What are we talking about here? Mighty most deaf.
It's simple mathematics. Check it out. I revolve around science.
What are we talking about here?
Mathematics.
Yeah, nothing like most deaf to get you going. Nothing like most deaf to get you going. Once again, this is Solo for the Your World News Media Collective, media outlet, community radio, whatever you want to call it. It's progressive folks, it's radical folks getting together and getting out in the streets and telling the stories that need to be told in the way with the critical analysis that needs to be told for the masses of oppressed brown and black skin folks and masses of oppressed people in general, because we know that oppression, it often wreaks its, it rears its ugly head on those of color, you know, by the forces of white supremacy and Eurocentrism. But, you know, unfortunately, sometimes those that are oppressed, that are the same color of the oppressors, they don't, you know, they're so intoxicated with racism that they're unable to see the oppression that is being placed upon them. But, you know, so Yoro News is going to break it down from that progressive, radical, left perspective, and primarily, you know, geared, you know, towards those masses of oppressed folks throughout the globe. So I'm solo, and I'm joined with my co-pilot on this journey that we take every whenever we want to do a show. How about that? Whenever we want to do a show, we take this ride, and you guys are on, you know, you the listeners are on board with us and help guide us towards places that we need to be. And so the vessels of our ancestors and radical and progressive minded heroes and sheroes guide us through, you know, those fallen political prisoners. They guide us, you know, all of them. They guide us, and it's their work that laid out the path for us to continue on the struggle. So we got a great show for you today. Peter and I have an outstanding show for you today. And, you know, I'm joined once again by my comrade in arms from the Deep South, the new Deep South, the new deep South, otherwise known as Arizona. He's sitting right in the belly of the heat box. Many of us are sitting in the oven, man, but it looks like, you know, Arizona, literally and figuratively, is a heat box. You know, it reaches 125 degrees there sometimes in the summer. And now the heat by the repressive government of Jan Brewer and her political clones, her cronies, the corrupt and nefarious individuals are wreaking havoc on brown and black skinned people throughout that state. And, you know, we got to do something about it. We have to continue to push back, and these regressive policies of SB 1070 and the policies that have now entered the public school system, negating, you know, ethnic studies to be taught. You know, these things have to be resisted. They have to be resisted. They have to be pushed back. And so Peter's joining us there today, and his background is really going to come into play today, because we've got a great show. I mean, we seem to often have great shows, but our great shows are marked by the guest and the stories that we have, and we're just the messengers. But we have a young sister coming on today, Amy B. She's going to she's going to give her story, and I had the opportunity to meet her a few weeks ago at a conference, National Black Student Leadership Conference, and it's a compelling story. I'm not going to speak on it. I'm going to let her tell the story, because she tells it much better than I ever could. But her strength and her conviction and her willingness to infiltrate and to change a system that has failed so many in the past, and Peter knows all too well about that, him being a former social worker. So, Peter, welcome to the show. I'm looking forward to this show, as I know you are.
Absolutely. Thanks again, Solomon. Always good to be with you, and I am looking forward to getting into the topic with our guest this afternoon, not only because my background is in social work, but because one of the cornerstones of the profession, of the discipline of social work, which is public policy, is so germane to our conversation today in terms of politics and what's going on nationally and internationally. So policy is germane to any conversation that we have on Your World News. So it's a good opportunity to take a look at it from a special angle today. So looking forward to getting into that today and continuing to take apart the wall of oppression in this oppressive, imperialist, and racist society. here in the United States. Looking forward very much to that. And I know Arizona gets a bad rap because of the policies that the state has promulgated recently. But it's a dry racism. So, you know, some people complain about the heat when there's no humidity out here. That's a dry racism. And that's just my attempt at humor. But, you know, the fact is that the policies that the state of Arizona have been putting forth lately are very much racist and oppressive and imperialist in nature. And we need to take seriously what policy is, what policy is all about, because although most of us are not involved in creating policy and in writing policy, policy affects each and every one of us every day. And so I hope we'll get a chance to talk about policy as it is, take maybe a little historical look at policy, and then see what we can do, see what all of us can do as freedom fighters to affect policy as a way of creating better living conditions for everybody.
Right, and you saw, as a social worker, you saw a lot of, and I know Amy is going to talk about this, but you, as a social worker, you got into the profession, as I know some of my very good friends are in social work, but you got into the profession to make a difference, to help individuals. And am I correct in the assertion that oftentimes unnecessary bureaucratic red tape prevented you from helping those that you were supposedly supposed to be paid to help? Am I correct on that?
You're spot on in saying that. You know, the reality is that, you know, there are various levels in social work, just like there are in any profession. And unfortunately, the level at which policy is created, the bureaucratic red tape, so to speak, is at a level that is so far removed from the level at which the people who are actually making a difference, the field workers, if you will, like if you education, you know, you have your teachers and your principals and your counselors. Those are the folks that are in the classroom, they're in the schools, they're in the hallways, making a difference with the kids. But unfortunately, those aren't the ones who are creating policies. Policies are being created and written, you know, someplace in a bureaucracy at a school, state school board level and legislature type levels, and in social work, you know, the policies that we were forced to follow were being created and written at a distance, far away, you know, by a level of bureaucracy that was far removed from the actual client systems that we were trying to help. And you're right. So the possibility for making a difference in the lives of individuals and the lives of neighborhoods and communities was greatly hindered by the bureaucracy and influenced by all kinds of things at the level of policy, which made it more difficult for those of us who were in the streets to make a difference in people's lives. And just to give you one example, when I left to go back to grad school, the job I had, I was working with, it was a diversion program to keep juvenile offenders out, try to keep them out of the system, try to keep them at home and in school and so forth. And so my job was literally in the streets, you know, with being with these kids. And I had the opportunity to spend up to a year with a client system or a family, the teenager that I was working with and his or her family, to try to make some difference in that teenager's life. And by the time I left, that period of time had been whittled down to 3 months. Now, try to make a difference in the life of a teenager who's got all kinds of issues going on in his or her life, who's been in and out of trouble already with the law and in school, and try to make a difference in an individual's life and in the life of the way a family functions in 3 months' time. And, you know, this, you know, obviously this is with a caseload of sometimes a couple dozen individuals. It's virtually impossible. And again, this policy was being created from a long way off by folks who just didn't understand the work we were doing. And it was a devastating revision of policy. that hampered my job to the point of nearly being impossible. So, you know, and there's I could tell you all kinds of stories about that, but that's just one example that stands out in terms of how policy and the policymakers who were removed from the hands-on everyday work in the street, how that hampers and that hinders the actual progress and actually making a difference in people's lives. And that's one of the reasons that there's such a high turnover rate, such a high burnout rate in the profession of social work, is because, you know, people go into it to try to make a difference, and those efforts are so often hindered or thwarted outright by the insane and contradictory policies that govern the profession. And so it can be very discouraging at times. And, you know, but hopefully we can do something about that, and I'm looking forward to talking with Amy and to get her perspective on where the profession is in the 21st century.
Right, definitely. I'm looking forward to that too. I really am, and I hope our listeners, whether they're listening on live or archive, you know, get a lot out of it and pass the word on, because, you know, what I like about her, and she'll get into that, is that she, you know, just like you said, she said that, you know, the change actually has to be policy-wise. You know,
right.
Those that go into it, you know, as social workers, their hands are tied unless somehow they get put in a position where they can change policy. But the policy has to, you know, the policies have to be changed. And so I'm looking forward to that. And speaking of policy, Peter, the policy of you know, death and destruction continue to go on. And, you know, and I hate to be the, you know, the bearer of bad news for folks and, you know, a downer. I'm sorry. This is not, you know, some mainstream Viacom-owned or Clear Channel-owned radio show. We're going to place a bunch of, you know, happy-go-lucky, corporate-driven, you know, racially stereotypical hip-hop songs, you know, just to pacify the masses of black and brown-skinned people in those cities where those radio stations are situated. You know, policy has long, for a long time, as you know, Peter, has been the rule of the day when it comes to structural and institutional racism, in terms of you know, just systematically, you know, keeping black and brown skin impoverished, and you know, black skin people are catching hell left and right. You know, we see some of these like latest numbers that have just come out, and it's just, you know, it's just amazing. You know, for every dollar that of wealth that a white person owns, a Latino person owns 12 cents, and a black person 10 cents. For every dollar of wealth, you know, a white person owns, a black person owns a dime. You know, for every dollar that a white person makes, you know, a black person makes either between 57 to 67 cents of that dollar. And that's astronomical, man. And you know, even beyond that, we look at these numbers that have come out, you know, where, you know, progressive economists have really shed some bright lights on these numbers that continue to show that 25-30 years ago, you know, when you look, you know, obviously you have to factor in inflation, but you look 25-30 years ago, workers, you know, they were making more. I mean, they were making more based on inflation than they are today. But yet today's workers are producing more, but making less than workers were 20, 25, 30 years ago. But on the flip side, the ruling class, those that own those factories, those that control and own the means of production of what is being produced, they continue to get richer, Peter, and they are systematically the ones that are the only ones that can afford these products that are being produced by this working class, oftentimes this poor working class, and it's just crazy. The working class can rarely afford the things that the items that they're producing at almost like slave wages. You know, when we look at the whole thing around minimum wage, and so it's getting worse, Peter. And you and I've had these conversations a lot off air, these, you know, and on air. But it's getting worse, and people have to like have to wake up. As you know, at the end of the School Days movie by Spike Lee, Lawrence Fishburne said, "Wake up, wake." I mean, we have to wake up. People have to wake up and understand this beast. And it's not. It doesn't matter what damn administration it is, especially if it's Democrat or Republican. It doesn't make any difference whatsoever. Obama and his administration continue to carry out the same economic policies that continue to make the rich richer, to continue to make the corporations filthy, dirty rich. But this has been going on for a long, long time. But above it all is this system of capitalism. This system of capitalism is squeezing the bloody life out of individuals, families, and communities from coast to coast. Am I not right?
Well, you're spot on. And one example is just hit the news yesterday. The executive order that came from Obama's desk of 18 January that's going to initiate a federal review of all federal regulations on business and finance industries. In other words, the big banks and finance firms and Wall Street, they're going to review the federal regulations under the guise of lifting restraints that might limit their ability to do their jobs. In other words, what that means is they're going to slash all kinds of regulations so that the financiers, the big banksters, the robber barons of the 21st century can continue to do just that, Solomon, continue to get richer, which means the poor will continue to get poorer. And that does come from the desk of a Democratic president. And it does not matter, in fact, what party is in power, because it is a capitalist system. The executive, the chief executive in a capitalist society, i.e. the president, is always going to be basically the steward for business interests. And so any president within this system is going to function in the interests and for the interests of big business. And so folks who are listening and still are holding out hope for Obama to make a difference, he can't make a difference because of the system in which he's stuck, because of the capitalist system. And that's why we need to look at things in terms of the system. We need to look at things from a structural perspective. It's not how an individual can get in and make a difference, but it's a structural issue. And as it relates to policy, we need to understand that, policy has to do with the structure of our society. And so when we look at things like poverty, it's absolutely insane to continue to have this medical model or this individualist perspective on things like poverty and unemployment, which leads to conclusions like, well, those who are in poverty, those who are unemployed or underemployed, just aren't thrifty enough. They just don't work hard enough. They just don't have what it takes. You know, that kind of social Darwinism is insane. And when in fact it's the structure, it's the system that breeds and produces unemployment and ill health and poverty and those kind of things. And so that's why policy is so significant, is to look at the structure that is being created and that has been created, that gives rise to the social ills that we're trying to struggle against today. And it is the capitalism is it. That's, we've got to keep that in the forefront of our thinking. Capitalism is the structure, and capitalism is the problem. And, we've talked about some of the other structural elements of capitalism, for example, militarism and war. And that is a structural component to maintain the capitalist system. The capitalist system depends on war, in order to obtain ever newer and broader markets and more and more labor, ever cheaper labor. And so we have this war machine in this country that goes to war for the corporations for their interests. And then, of course, racism. Racism is another evil spawn of capitalism, because capitalism depends on a workforce, a labor force, that is divided amongst itself and continuing to point the finger back and forth. And you know, and this the ethnic and racial climate in this country has been a textbook example of the divide and conquer routine of the oppressor. And you know, for the first several hundred years, it was blacks against whites. You know, especially after emancipation, whites pointed the finger at blacks. Well, you know, the black folks are taking white people's jobs. Well, of course, that was nonsense, and that was a narrative and a myth cooked up by the capitalists to take the guilt, the light of guilt, the light of day off of the capitalists themselves. And you know, that played out for over a century, and now we've got another scapegoat thrown into the mix. You know, it's the Latinos and the Chicanos and all these immigrants, right? The illegal immigrants. That's the language today. And we've said on the show before, you know, no human beings illegal. You know, undocumented workers coming into the country are being blamed for taking our jobs. Well, obviously that's nonsense. It's just another divide and conquer methodology of the oppressor. And what we really need to do is go back and look at the structure, look at the system, and look at the policies that are being put in place. Policies, for example, like NAFTA, like GATT. You know, these are policies, my brother. These are policies that are in writing that have led to the destruction of entire communities, having led to the impoverishment of entire communities south of the border and even within the United States. And it's those things that we as citizens need to be aware of and need to be familiar with, that it's policies like the North American Free Trade Agreement and like GATT and some of those other things that lead to the types of economic inequality, and not the presence of people who look different from each other. That's insane, but it's a structure that is built up on the legs of various policies. And so it's important that we understand that, you know, and not buy into the narrative and not get brainwashed by the social Darwinism and the xenophobia of the narrative that would have us fighting amongst each other. That's very important.
Right, exactly. And that's, you know, when you talk about GATT, you know, folks that don't know, GATT is, you know, General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. But when you look at, you know, the whole major protest that occurred in Seattle, you know, many years ago, I think it was sometime in the late 90s, you know, obviously the mainstream media played it up as, you know, just a bunch of radical, like, hippies just protesting, whatever. No, they were protesting, as Peter just said, these just like these rapacious, mendacious, like trade policies that were set up just to benefit the ruling class from various countries, and to continue to just squeeze and squeeze and squeeze the working class and the poor in so-called, you know, third world or developing nations, you know, and people got out and they protested, you know, and so. I implore anyone listening right now that hasn't heard of GATT or hasn't heard of the World Trade Organization, you know, look them up. Go to SourceWatch and look them up. You know, go to Google, type in General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. Look up NAFTA. Look up look up CAFTA. Just type in these acronyms. You know, NAFTA, and you know, you'll see a description, but then you have to look deeper. You know, Google will provide you a definition of what NAFTA is. Probably they'll probably pull up Wikipedia, read through that, but then also go, you know, click back and then look at some of, like, at all the articles that are written, and you'll find some very progressive leaning articles that will give you, you know, a version of what NAFTA does that the corporate media doesn't talk about. The corporate media, when they talk about NAFTA, you know, they talk about Bill Clinton and the Republican-led Congress, you know, in the 90s that made way for NAFTA. But they don't, you know, they're not going to, you know, talk about, You know, they, sometimes they might even slip in there and talk about how Ross Perot opposed NAFTA, which he did. But very, very rarely, I mean, if ever, will the corporate media take it a step further and talk about what NAFTA has done to poor people in Mexico. Very rarely will they put it in that, in the perspective, the lens, in terms of how it affects poor working class folks in Mexico, and how these U.S. corporations, they'll talk about how the U.S. corporations, you know, Peter, it's interesting, when they talk about the negative aspects of these things, what's interesting is they talk about how NAFTA has just drawn, you know, has taken U.S. manufacturing jobs out of say, you know, Cleveland, out of Flint, out of the Midwest, out of, you know what I'm saying, out of the U.S. in general, and how it's affected, you know, the working class here, which it has. But, Peter, it usually stops right there. They don't take it to the next level and say, oh, okay, let's also talk about how it has affected, you know, those same working class poor folks, but just in a different country, in a country, say, south of the border, our neighbors in Mexico. You know, very rarely will they take the step further and talk about how, you know, you have women working in these factories, in these U.S. factories in Mexico, basically to call it chump change would be euphemistic to call it chump change. But they're making literally wages that you would find in the prison industrial complex system in the U.S. I mean, you know, anywhere from 75 cents to $3 a day, you know. And so they don't, you know, so it's funny, like, when they talk about, you know, and that's kind of like the whole Americanism kind of thing, and that's what has really robbed so many of us of our compassion, so many of us that are not wealthy, that are not rich, that are in fact working class, that are poor. We've allowed the ruling class through their media system to get us mad at some policies sometimes, but to only look at how the policies have affected, how they've affected, you know, us, but not to look at how these policies also rear their ugly heads, you know, on poor people, brown skin, black skin people in other countries, you know, and you know that has gone the way with military, you know, it, you know. You know, we talk about, you know, the military, you know, Peter, you know, they'll talk about, we'll actually have, you know, some of these, you know, so-called, you know, liberal Republicans or so-called, you know, if it's possible, some of these so-called progressive Democrats that, you know, when they talk about the war sometimes that, you know, especially on the part of the Republicans, you know, the ones who now, like, you know, I've, you know, you'll listen to Joe Scarborough, you know, on his show in the mornings on MSNBC, where he'll talk about sometimes how this ill-fated war in Afghanistan continues to take the lives of thousands of young men and young women, you know, from the U.S. You know, so he'll specifically say, you know, some of our best and brightest, you know, young men and young women in the U.S. military have lost their, you know, continue to lose their lives in this ill-fated war. He'll never take this. He doesn't take the damn step forward and talk about the tens of thousands of folks in Afghanistan who have already lost their lives, innocent civilians who have lost their lives through this occupation, this nefarious, evil, demonic war that is so impersonal. That oftentimes death and destruction find their way screaming and scorching their way through the sky from F-16 fighters or from manless, these chicken shits, you know, operating these manless drones from, you know, someplace in Nevada, you know, dropping, you know, these missiles from these predator drones. And so I want to play this. Because Peter, I want to get your thoughts on the other side. But I want to play this because this really speaks volumes to it. And this was like really a brilliant analysis and a scathing analysis by Glenn Ford, looking at America. and it's violent ways.
The gruesome murders in Tucson have prompted a huge chorus of establishment voices to call for a ratcheting down of political rhetoric, lest the more mentally unbalanced among us become unhinged, as is thought to have been the case with the Arizona shooter. At times like these, it is considered unseemly to put such tragedies into a larger American context of violence, a bit like going to a funeral and mentioning that lots of people died on the same day as the dearly departed, which would be a crude and boorish thing to do. The problem is, many of the mourners in this virtual national funeral procession have already brought their own agendas to the sad occasion. The rich and powerful believe it is their privilege to preach over the bodies in order to properly spin the victims into the hereafter. And that means that the rest of us must also treat the sad occasion as a political event, and so I will. Lots of people do die from the violence that America's political system engenders, tens of thousands every year here at home, and hundreds of thousands, if not millions, around the world. The U.S. is uniquely violent among the rich nations of the planet, and that is because of its fundamental political history and social and economic arrangements. American class and racial structures are not only the fruits of great historical crimes of horrific violence, they also require unending applications of violence in order to sustain the prevailing social and economic order. Therefore, when those who have grown rich from organized violence, who are the same people who have made America, in Dr. Martin Luther King's words, the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, start talking about ratcheting down the rhetoric so as not to encourage violence, it's time for us to do the opposite. We must become fixated on violence, hyper-conscious of the violence that is inflicted on our communities and on peoples and nations around the planet by the people who benefit from what Dr. King called the triple evils, racism, militarism, and materialism. Put in other terms, that's white supremacy, U.S. imperialism, and rule of the rich. Those who profit from the existence of the triple evils are the fountainheads of the great violence that afflicts our nation and the world. It is no wonder that the most racist political organizations, like the Tea Party, are also the greatest fomenters of domestic violence. They are political heirs to the slave master, who could not have existed without daily application of the most extreme violence on the slave. The militaristic and imperial American state fosters a mass culture of violence that saturates the society at large, inculcating disrespect for human life in general and absolute contempt for the lives of non-Europeans the world over. And the values of the rich, most especially the Wall Streeters that exercise complete hegemony over the machinery of government and the communications apparatus, are those of the mass killer, because the rich few can only remain in power by being prepared to murder the many who have nothing. So, by all means, let's examine violence in and from America, and then let's ratchet up the struggle against the real culprits who profit from a culture of violence. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
Pete, I'll let you take that.
You know, Glenn is spot on again with this treatment of what happened here in Tucson recently, and it's very much a political event, and the political circus that has followed that tragic shooting has been very instructive in terms of the political essence of our politicians, of the talking heads, the punditry, et cetera. And some of the things that Glenn points out here, I want to come back to. And, you know, he talks about the U.S. being uniquely violent, you know, and that's something that, you know, it's easy for some of us to take for granted, because being students of politics and being students of culture, we understand that. But you know, we all do well to step back for a minute and just try to be objective as we can, and examine the violence that permeates American society on an everyday basis. And just to see, you know, is that normative? Is that what life is like? Is that what life is supposed to be like? Is that what life is like around the globe? Is that what life is like in other countries, in Scandinavian countries, in Western European countries, in South and Central American countries, in African countries? You know, is it so permeated with violence the way the United States is? And the answer is no. In every case, the answer is no. You can go country by country by country and examine violence, and the United States, like Glenn said, is in fact uniquely violent, not only among rich nations, the way Glenn mentioned, but among all nations in terms of, you know, per capita incarceration rates, per capita murder rates, and I want to include in the concept of violence not only physical violence, bodily violence, where bodily harm is done, but I want to talk about economic violence, because that, you know, violence is doing harm to one's person or property, and the economic violence that's being perpetrated by the financial sector in this country, especially over the last roughly 10 years, has been just as devastating, if not more so, than the physical violence that we see in the streets on a day-to-day basis. So the United States is, in fact, uniquely violent in the sense that it is infinitely more violent than certainly any other developed country on the planet, and probably more than any other country, period. And we see that violence in so many ways. We see harm coming to people physically and bodily through assaults and robberies and murders that are just off the scale. And, you know, to give you a good contrast and comparison, one of Michael Moore's films, Solomon, you might know which one it is, where he, I think it's Bowling for Columbine, because you know, Moore is originally from the Flint, Michigan area, which is not too far from Detroit, and Detroit has been notorious for being one of the most violent cities in the United States, and Detroit is right across the Detroit River from the city in Canada that's right there across the Detroit River. I mean, it's literally across a bridge from the city of Detroit. And in the film, Michael Moore walks around the city. The name of the city will come to me, I'm sure, at some point. But he walks through the streets of that town, and he walks up to people's houses, and their doors are unlocked. He literally opens their doors and says, you know, hey, hello, anybody home? And people come to the door and have conversations with him. And he asks some of them, you know, do you have a gun in the house? And they look at him like, well, no, why would I have a gun in the house? You know, but others do. I mean, others do. The fact of the matter is that Canadians also own a lot of guns. Canadians love their guns almost as much as Americans do. And yet and still, the level of violence there is just a tiny fraction of the level of violence, including gun violence, that we have here in the United States. So there is, in fact, a culture of violence. I mean, how else to explain it? A culture of violence. And there is an unending application of violence, to use Glenn's words, that go on within the borders of this country and without the borders of this country. Obviously, it's a daily ritual of unending violence that the U.S. military perpetrates in nations like Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, and a whole host of other countries at various points in time. You know, so there is an unending application of violence and an unending war. Really, if you go back to the end of World War II, there's been virtually nonstop warfare being perpetrated by the United States government somewhere around the globe. And the fact that there are, you know, nearly 1,000 military bases around the planet and over in dozens of countries, you know, that only points up the reality that violence and war is the default mode of operation for the federal government of the United States. And Glenn also made a tremendous historical connection to the slaveocracy that existed in the United States prior to the end of the Civil War in 1865, and the violence that was obviously necessary to propagate that kind of a barbaric and inhumane system of chattel slavery. Violence was absolutely necessary. It was just commonplace. It's the way it was. And so that points up again the reality of a culture of violence, where violence is just seen as normative. It's just seen as normative. It's just part of the fabric of daily life in America. And then we, again, fast forward to the 21st century, and you look at what are the most popular video games, the most popular computer games that young people are playing. They're all about violence. They're all about the military.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's all about warfare and assassinations and special operations, and you know, and so this culture of violence is carefully controlled, manipulated, and operated in the interests of this capitalist structure. Okay, in the interests of this militarized society. So that violence becomes so normative for the rest of us that we don't even question the deaths of hundreds of thousands of Iraqis, on top of hundreds of thousands of Afghans, on top of hundreds of thousands of Vietnamese, on top of, you know, and a list goes on and on. We don't even question that. You know, because violence and death is just so normative. It's just what we, you know, it's the way life is, when in fact it's not. And it should not be, you know. And we have we have the responsibility to say, no, this is wrong. This is not the way life is supposed to be. It is not supposed to be so violent. And we can look to other cultures around the planet and throughout the course of time that point up the reality that human beings are not inherently or by nature violent or warmongers. There are all kinds of cultures that demonstrate the reality that human beings can be peaceful. And live, you know, coexist peacefully with one another. I mean, the natives who were here in North America are great examples of those kind of social relations. And you know, another thing that Glenn said, everybody that's listening to needs to hear Glenn say this again, that the rich few in this country under a capitalist system, the rich few are always prepared to murder the many, all right? So, in other words, all of us who are listening right now are targets of the few who are in control and who have the power and who have the wealth and who own the means of production and who own and operate the political machinery in this country. They are always ready to murder us. You know, we look at the militarization and the police state reality becoming commonplace in the United States, and it's evidence to the fact that they are ready to murder us at any given moment. Now, you can do some research on your own and look at the series of executive orders that were signed by George Bush Jr. toward the end of his presidency, and then continued by Barack Obama in the early years of his presidency, a series of executive orders for the initiation of police state in the United States in the event of a catastrophic event. So the government already has that system in place, just like the Patriot Act was already written and ready to go. You know, September 11th, you know, we had the destruction the Twin Towers. How did this, you know, thousands of pages legislation just appear the next day? You know, isn't that just interesting that this, you know, thousands of pages long document showed up on the desk of legislators the very next day, you know, and they voted on it without reading through it. You know, so, the measures were already in place. And do the research yourself. Go find those executive orders. I wish I had more information on them in front of me, but I don't. But there are a series of executive orders signed by George Bush Jr. and Barack Obama that make ready the police state in the United States to prevent any kind of revolt of the many. All right. So what that is, it is the actualization of what Glenn Ford said just a few minutes ago: the rich few being ready to murder the non-rich many. All right. And that's us. That's you and me. All right. That's me and everybody who's listening to us right now. They're ready to imprison us and to murder us if necessary, if we step up and try to challenge the status quo and to try to challenge what? The policies that govern the status quo right now. And then the last thing I want to say about this, Solomon, is that what Glenn the way Glenn broke down that massacre and the context around it is he points up the reality of values and how values translate into actions, and how values, especially in the context of our show tonight, how values translate into policy. And I want to come back to that throughout the course of the show as it relates to policy. So I just wanted to put that on the table now. But one of the things that we see with the Tucson shooting and the tragedy that unfolded in Tucson is one of the values of Americanism, because we all saw how the regressives got on the defensive after the massacre here in Tucson and disclaimed any responsibility, right? You know, for that kind of violence breaking out, despite their hostile and violent rhetoric, and they're calling for reload, lock and load, and putting targets on maps, and saying things like we should assassinate the president and that kind of madness. They disclaim any responsibility for that and say we had nothing to do with that, right? We've all seen the circus unfold. And what that points to is one of the values of Americanism, which is disintegration, all right? In other words, they are basically stating that, what their words and their actions have absolutely no impact on the behaviors and the beliefs of other people, which, of course, is nonsense on its face, because if they believed that their words didn't have any impact on people's beliefs and behaviors, they wouldn't be on the radio and they wouldn't be on television in the first place. Am I right? And yet, still, when something tragic happens, they claim that they have no impact or no influence on people. And so it's this value of disintegration, where they don't see reality as in its wholeness, as a unified whole. And they just don't see that they had, that kind of, year after year after year of radio show and television show that espouses violence and that creates a climate of hostility, that doesn't have any impact on the behaviors of people like the shooter here in Tucson and so many other the guy who killed Joe Tiller a couple years ago and these other various incidents. So it points to some values that exist in the American system, and I'm going to continue to bring that up tonight as we talk about policy and we talk about values and how values translate into policy in this country.
Yeah, I mean, translate to policies. I mean, within this country, I mean, we see how it affects policies throughout Central Asia, throughout the Middle East. Specifically looking at Palestine and how the continuation of U.S. taxpayer dollars, amounting anywhere between $5 and $7 billion per year, goes to the only country in the Middle East that has bona fide nuclear warheads. That's Israel, and this is as oppressive a country as we've seen. It's up there with South Africa under apartheid. I mean, folks and most Americans are just dumbed down and blinded by their own inability to critically think and to see past what the media feeds them all the time. And what the media feeds them is that Palestinians are they're terrorists, they're this, that, and the other. But yet, these are people who had their land stolen, who are even beyond that, are languishing, like literally languishing in Gaza. The largest, what's known as the largest open-air prison in the world, Gaza. I mean, they cannot control their water. They cannot control their electricity. It is controlled from Tel Aviv and other parts of Israel with literally the flick of a switch. They cannot travel throughout their country without going through myriad of checkpoints by, these ridiculously like racist and power hungry IDF soldiers that are set in place to just patronize and to denigrate them. We know about Operation Cast Lead and you know how that took, you know, 1,300 lives. But also in between that, every week there are Palestinians that die unjustly, that die needlessly, you know, because, for instance, they can't get to a hospital. So if they need major surgery or major treatment, they can't even get to a hospital. They have to literally jump through hoops to try to get to a decent hospital outside of Gaza. I mean, it's you know, but this is all financed by U.S. capital, by U.S. taxpayers, and unfortunately with the complicity of most Americans. Now we know there's a lot of Americans out there that protest this, but they are in the extreme minority of Americans. Most Americans are complicit in this through just sheer, like, you know, just ignorant apathy. You know, some support what is going on, because they've been fed by the U.S. government that, you know, that Israel is the U.S.'s, you know, one of the U.S.'s chief ally, and so they take upon that mantle and say, yeah, such and such. But we don't even have to look to, you know, outside U.S. borders to see how policies affect individuals in a very violent manner. You mentioned a police state. I mean, you look at most brown and black skin communities, whether it's Baltimore City, Washington, D.C., South Central L.A., Detroit, Michigan. You see policies. You see policies that have been affected by the media. I mean, the media has enormously affects public policy in terms of the policing of brown and black skin communities. You know, blacks are you know, systematically overrepresented as the perpetrators of violent crimes, and most white folks would tell you that in their warped reality, they think that, you know, this is you know, a great many white folks will tell you that, you know, in their reality, they think that, you know, if they have to fear anyone, they have to fear like a black man, that, you know, if they have to fear anyone for murder, I fear a black man. That's my number one threat in terms of what could murder me. In all actuality, you know, 86-87% of all homicides within the white community are committed by white people themselves. I mean, people tend to murder within their own community, but the media drums it up. I mean, there's been systematic reports that have been done. There've been just many reports that have done. Like Berkeley did a report, you know, a few years ago that showed, you know, how these media policies affect communities where. If it, you know, there's a term that says if it bleeds, it leads. And so, you know, you have these instances where a few years ago in California, out of every 10 stories on violent crimes that led, seven of them featured youth, you know, as the violent as the perpetrators of these violent crimes. But in actuality, Peter, when they looked at the whole aggregate number of crimes, violent crimes specifically, that were committed in that individual year, and I think it was several years ago, but it wasn't within the past decade. And but when they looked at the aggregate amount of violent crimes, Peter, they found that it was actually something like 13% of all violent crimes in California in that particular year were actually committed by youth. But,
wow.
You know, in people's reality, you know what I'm saying? People's reality that have no understanding of critical thought and don't know how to deconstruct dominant narratives that are fed to them, boom. You know what I'm saying? You know, since they're seeing 7 out of 10 stories featuring youth,
yeah.
With, you know what I'm saying? Boom. That's, you know, and these policies, and we see these policies make their way into school systems, but they also make their way into communities. I mean, we saw what happened to Ayanna Stanley Jones. We see like the vast amount of young black men that are killed, unarmed by police.
Right.
This
right.
is policy that's set in place. And yes, there's a lot of intersectionalities that connect it. Yes, there's white supremacy, structural racism, but also the media. The media is one of those intersectionalities that connected. And one of the things that, you know, this is a story that just came out. In the state of Texas, they are now handing out, in the schools, this was elementary and middle school students. Instead of handing out detentions, they are handing out tickets where the parents actually have to take the students to a small police department that is within, you know what I'm saying, that community, and they have to go there. They're handing out tickets. I am not making this up. I am not making this up. This is incredible. That I see we have our guest on, and we can continue this on the line, and she can speak to a range of things, including this, because she comes from one of those cities that the police has oftentimes reared its ugly head and doesn't have the best relationship with brown and black skinned people and people, you know, to somehow, you know, just bewilder people seem to try to wonder why black and brown skin folks don't have, for the most part, don't have a good working relationship or a good view of the police, because the police has systematically, for more times than not, has been used as a state-sponsored arm to suppress
right.
and arrest, repress people within those communities. And so, but we're gonna shift the tides a little bit. And we're going to welcome, give a warm Your World News radical welcome to Miss Amy B. And I'm going to let her introduce herself and tell you who she is. And Amy, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Welcome to Your World News. This is Solomon. And joined on the line as well is my co-host, Peter Fowler from Glendale.
Hello, Amy.
Hello.
And he's a former social worker as well, and he, you know, that will come out in the course of this interview. But I've let the listeners know how I was fortunate enough to meet you at the National Black Student Leadership Conference, and how your story was what was the most important thing that I remember from that conference by far. It inspired me, empowered me. One of the first people I called when I got back was Peter, and I said, we got to get her on the show. You know, her story is powerful, is progressive, and this is a young woman that I also all my support behind, because if we can get you and more folks like you in the system to in positions of power, as you said yourself, you know, positions that affect
yes.
policy, we can actually make some kind of change. So I'd like if you could just lead us off with, can you tell us your story, your story, the story that you told me when I met you at the conference that you said that you were looking forward to telling other folks too. We're going to get into this. She's also a burgeoning author. She's writing a book, and let her talk about that later. But I can't wait to purchase a copy of her book. But could you tell us your story?
Yes, I grew up in public housing. My mom and dad were basically having an adulterous affair, so I always felt like the odd man out, you know, seeing that I had contact with both families, but also within the public housing community, because my mom read to me from the time that I was in her womb. You know, I could read and I could speak very well, and I was called Black Amy, White Amy in a black girl's body. And I just wanted to fit in. That was my main, focus back then, was to be able to fit in into that circle. No matter that when I went to school, I was more friends with the Caucasians and the Asian and Filipino students, you know, once I got home, it really didn't matter. I wanted to be social amongst, you know, my own people. But I was pretty much shunned back then for the type of person that I was. But I fought very hard to fit in, you know, dating older men. And I think that what opened the door for that was me being molested by a minister from the time I was 8 to 12. So I'm guessing that made it easier for me to have boyfriends that were 10, 12, 14 years older than me, especially if they had something going for themselves because, you know, we lived in the projects. We really didn't have great income. And so I learned early on how to manipulate from that standpoint. But I also ran into the wrong type of character, and it was a drug dealer. We had a very abusive relationship, mostly mentally and emotionally, but sometimes physically as well. And towards the end of the relationship, when I started to blossom into my own and come into my own independence, that independence threatened this individual, and they introduced me to drugs. So, you know, I've lived that lifestyle of being an addict. It has caused me to lose a lot, including children and jobs and vehicles and even being homeless. And I came into the system from the time I was born. You know, my mom, she was on public assistance and so on and so forth. And as I got older and started having children, I followed down that same path. And I have my own misgivings about, I don't even know whether to call it I guess I'll call it an institution because it's not an industry, but it feels like you're dealing with industry people just from the attitudes and biases that you have to deal with, you know.
All right. Mm-hmm. Hi, Amy. This is Peter Fowler. I appreciate that story. And, you know, as Solomon mentioned, my background is in social work. So I want to ask you if you could kind of continue your story in terms of what led you to want to go into social work as a profession, and also what kind of social work do you want to do, especially for our listeners who aren't familiar with social work from the inside. What kind of opportunities are there in social work that you are attracted to as opposed to those that you're not attracted to? Basically, you know, what's your vision in terms of what you want to do as a social worker? So, like, how did you get to the point where you wanted to go into social work, and what kind of things do you want to do with that?
Like I said, with me being in the system for many years, I had built up an animosity towards the social work institution. Just anything had to do with a social worker, I just felt very uncomfortable, but at the same time I felt enslaved, although a lot of choices that I made landed me in that position. It still feels like a bondage situation. And then with dealing with some social workers who already are biased, or they have they just have a hard time showing compassion towards the client, or empathy, or I understand what you mean. I know where you're coming from. I could be around a social worker, and I can feel the hair stand up on my arms and on my neck, and I have to pray and I have to ask God, because it is He that brought me this far, you know, and helped me through all of this. But I have to pray and ask for the strength not to have an attitude with them or show any outward attitude. So I couldn't stand social workers, I'll put it that way. You know, I'm sugarcoating it, but just to be honest, I couldn't stand them. I went through a program, it's called the Fresh Start Program, which lasted for 12 weeks. And I'm mentioning them also because they have lost funding. It was a program for 5 years, but it's helped many people. And towards the end, that's when I realized that the people who were helping me were social workers. They didn't come from that standpoint. They came from the realest of the real and just what you're going through and trying to help you in a very basic way. So that is really what turned me on. I walked into their office and saw the diplomas for MSSW and so on and so forth, and it just sparked something up in me that I've always loved to help people. I always wanted to be a helper of people, and I had a distaste for the system that I have lived through. And that's one reason I wanted to be a social worker. I wanted to get out there and show them how it's supposed to be done, that you're supposed to love people. I know that there's policy and guidelines. A lot of times those policies and guidelines are broken, but at the discretion of the person who you're dealing with. But at the same time, I would like to affect policy because of everything that I've been through, the help and the hurt, most certainly the hurt. What I would like to be able to be within that system, helping people with compassion, helping people who may have walked my shoes, or maybe they've been in shoes worse than mine, or maybe they're walking around out there barefoot and have no idea that they're about to put on my shoes. I want to be that person that they run into instead of some of the callousness that I've seen within the system. You know, the policy is one thing. The type of policies that are in place, you know, it's so much red tape and it's so much rigmarole and things that you have to go through. A lot of times you either don't get the help. If you do get the help, it is not adequate enough help. You're still going to be made to feel less than. When if I'm coming to you for help, I don't want to be made to feel less than. And I want to be that person that uplifts the spirit of the men and women that come before me.
So it sounds like you're interested in going into like hands-on kind of work, working with people directly. Is that accurate?
Initially, I want to experience that. I want to experience that, but I also have my own ideas about therapy. So I would like to go into unconventional methods to use the arts, the natural gifts and talents that people have every day. If it's recognized, it can be used as therapy for themselves and therapy for others. So, you know, that's something that I know I couldn't do within the agencies, but maybe a nonprofit or something might be suffice enough for me to accomplish that. And I would like to affect policy.
Yeah.
There's a lot of things that I want to ultimately, that is what I want. I want to be in position so that I can, from the standpoint of someone who came through the system, of someone who has lived in the street, who's been homeless, and so on and so forth, and show them, okay, not only have I come out, but also I can tell you what I see that maybe you're either not looking at or you just can't see. And
let me ask you
that
this, in terms of affecting policy, Amy, what are some areas in particular of policy that you see as problematic and the kind of things you'd like to make some changes? I mean, let's say you had the opportunity to start to make some changes and to affect policy. What kind of changes, what kind of differences would you like to see happen?
I would like to see, I'm quite sure they're going to have guidelines, but at the same time, it's people that are dying in the streets and you're waiting on a signature. My file is on your desk. It's got to be a more efficient way to address some of these problems. I know that sometimes when you help people, they're still going to have problems anyway, but it's got to be a more efficient way to address that. Also, school. School should be a priority. I'm a college student now, and I know a lot of persons with degrees that are delivering pizzas, and I can't imagine if you didn't make school a priority. There's a great chance that you could go out there and really make a good income. But at the same time, if that's not a priority of the agencies, a lot of people want to push you out there to work. And you're out there working with no experience. So I feel like no experience and no education, so you have no safety net. And you have nothing to pull you forward from. Okay, you may start out at McDonald's, but that should not be your end goal. And if you don't afford me the opportunity to go to school, I know a lot of young women, including myself, when I was on TANF and receiving food stamps, they gave me such hassle for not working and for going to school. And you know, it's so much paperwork that had to go into whether or not they were going to help me so that I could sustain my household, feed myself, feed my daughter, but also pursue my dreams. I know that it was choices that landed me there. You know, I didn't get someone didn't just walk up to me and all of a sudden I'm pregnant. So I had to make a choice that landed me in that predicament. But once I need the help, if the help is there, the help should be there without the stigma and without the nastiness, and also with acknowledging the fact that you got an education, most likely, don't you think I should have one as well?
Yeah, and Amy, I'm glad you brought that up, because you know, when I saw you gathered around, you know, or where I saw that cipher of students that you were a part of, you know, at the conference, and you were, you know, telling that story, there was one story that you told that was in relation to one of those policy issues that you mentioned, and one of the, I guess, one of the systematic issues in terms of work that you had gone through the system. You had been in the system, and then you went out there to get a legitimate job, and, you know, at a hotel, and I don't know if you want to extend on that story.
Yeah, I was at the time in recovery from my addiction, and we were homeless, though. Yeah, and we lived in a shelter, and they said someone in the family has to work. And at the time, I was fighting for my husband's Social Security because he was diagnosed MMR. He had gotten it all his life since second grade, and when he became an adult, they said, okay, well, now you have to prove to us that you're disabled. So that's another story. I don't know how you can tell someone for that many years that they're mildly mentally retarded and then have them prove it to you. But we went through 3 years of fighting that. And in that time, we were living within the homeless shelter, and I had to go out for work. They give you 30 days. It took me longer than 30 days, so they had to give me a two-week extension. And within those 2 weeks, the hotel called me that is out here in Portsmouth, and it's a drug-infested hotel. And my fear was I can't, even though I told them I was in recovery, I can't tell them that I'm at a high-risk environment because they already gave me the extension. You know, I'm not trying to get put out of the homeless shelter. So I took the job, and I was third shift front desk clerk, so I got to see all the comings and goings, and I relapsed. And I went back to the shelter, and I was honest and told them I had relapsed, and they said it was protocol that they call Child Protective Services. Child Protective Services came in and said that they wanted to do a two-week removal of my son, and just trial. So I said, okay, let me cooperate. I'll let you do a trial remover. I have never gotten my son back. They used my husband's disability, the fact that I allowed him to watch his own child while I work. The child was 6 months old. I had told him everything that he needed to know, and not only did he take care of our son while I was at work, but we were one of two married couples in a homeless shelter. Everyone else was single mothers, and they all had to go out and find a job, and they didn't want to pay daycare. So my husband was the free daycare. None of those records were subpoenaed to show that he was capable of watching not one, not two, but 3 to 4 infants at a time. And just the policies that they had in place, we never received my son back. My son is now 7 years old. He is here in Portsmouth right under my nose, But he was even adopted out without me being told. The lawyer dropped the case and went to a higher court. The higher court said it was out of their jurisdiction, and it was just a big runaround. And very unfortunate.
Oh my goodness. You know, that's astounding. That's absolutely astounding. You know, that your child was adopted out like that without your input, and that points to some serious deficits in the system. And one of the things that's problematic with the system, as you well know, and I learned through experience the hard way, is the lack of funding for so many good programs that are out there or that could be out there. They either don't have the funding to continue, they don't have the funding to start up, they don't have the funding to hire the best workers out there. I know things probably haven't changed too much since I was in the profession, but social workers don't make a lot of money unless you go into some kind of clinical private practice kind of thing. What do you suggest or would you like to see to make some improvements there to start to close some gaps in terms of the economic issues that are so real in social work, things like programs not getting adequate funding, particularly in, you know, we're seeing all these economic problems in the country now that those things are liable to only get worse. What kind of things would you like to see that maybe remedy some of those economic issues?
Okay, first and foremost, I would like to see some honesty and some accountability, because yes, the economy is bad, but that is so vague of an idea, because there are things that still thrive and things that don't. And in my opinion, and this is my opinion, that there is money out there. It is just not being allotted to the programs. There's a lot of people who, of course, don't want to take a pay cut, and they're in the position not to take a pay cut, so therefore they're going to cut whatever programs you have. But one instance in reference to what I just went through with my son is foster care is big business, big business. You know, not only do the states get money from the government when they meet a certain quota of children removed, but also the foster parents are given a substantial amount as opposed to what actual parent, biological parent of the child receives. And not only are you given monetary support, but also you're giving items like cribs and strollers and things. Yeah, of course, they give away child seats for everybody. But there's so much more that they will give to a foster parent than they would to the biological parent. So I feel like it's money out there. You know, what they pay per month for some things, they just don't want to pay for other things. You know, money is already tight. I believe that there needs to be some accountability, some honesty, and some sacrifice for the greater good.
And that's a good point. I love what you just mentioned, Amy, because the money is out there. And unfortunately, you know, we live within a society where, you know, it literally pays to have folks dumbed down and to really not understand the complexity of their own government. I should say the simplicity of their own government, from the standpoint that it's really simple. Amy, you just broke it down critically, and you just hit it on the head when you said the money has got to be out there, and it's based on priorities in terms of the greater good. And right now, the greater good, you know, we're spending $1 trillion, or the U.S. government is spending over $1 trillion per year on military campaigns in Afghanistan, Iraq, and in Pakistan, and also towards the funding of well over 700 military bases throughout the globe. I mean, no other country comes close to that, So if they were even to scale back their military priorities and to close up some of those bases and to bring those military forces to the home and use those military forces to, like, for instance, you know, if Hurricane Katrina, God forbid, ever happen again, you have those military forces that can move in there right away, immediately, and help out the folks and keep them based here, which would save hundreds of millions of dollars. And that
save
money could
millions
go
of
into
dollars yeah. in lives.
Exactly, into lives like right here. Exactly, to, you know, going towards affordable housing for everybody, towards eradicating poverty, and putting money into social services
healthcare.
That can actually help and save lives and healthcare. I mean, for God's sakes, if you have countries that don't even come close to the annual GDP that this country, you know, pushes out, you know, in terms of all the goods and services produced in this country, you have countries, you know, like Cuba that has a much better healthcare system, and every Cuban citizen has free universal healthcare. Venezuela, Norway, I mean, we can go on and on. The U.S. is the very last industrialized country since World War II to have any kind of universal healthcare contract for its people, and there's a reason for that. And so, I like the fact that you brought that up, which brings me to you spoke very, very passionately about the fact, you know, and people, you know, what really drove me to this sister is that she was extremely ardent, you know, about everything that she's talking about right now. I mean, very, very passionate. And that was one of the things that caught me the most, is that, you know, you see some people talk about these things and they kind of just ho-hum. When you have somebody that talks about it through passion, they understand the crisis and they understand the urgency. You know, when there's an urgency that has to do with people's lives and an issue that has to be tackled immediately, because people are literally dying day by day because of it, they cannot help but speak passionately. And you spoke, Amy, about the fact that it has to be policy-wise. That was driving you is that you don't just want to get your degree in social work, is that you want to climb the ladder and get deep into the system so that you can affect policy, because that is the only way. Why is policy so vital to change this system?
Everything is based on policy. Everything is based on guidelines and legal jargon, and it trickles down to lives that are not even being acknowledged. It's just a cloud of paperwork. That's the only thing that I see. I can't even describe it. You know, every time I get choked up as I think about it, that while people are pushing pens and they're pushing paper, they are not thinking about the individual lives that are affected every day. Even as simple as the National Institute of Health, because 1 in 4 African Americans die of heart disease. They've come up with this program to teach persons within public housing how to teach others about health, heart disease. And we're doing this program, but it's a pilot program, and it's still, even though they want this program to go through in order for us to get it funding, it is still so much red tape and applications. Now, I feel like once you get the buy-in of what you're trying to tell me, you're telling me 1 in 4 Africans die of heart disease, you're telling me you got this great curriculum where we can teach for 10 weeks all the risk factors and aspects concerning it, but even though you're telling me all of this and you get me gung-ho and you said, you know what, because it's much worse, even though it's 1 in 4 African Americans worldwide and within the public housing community, it's a much disparaging situation, so therefore that's where we're targeting, and we have this especially made for you. But I can't get funding unless I jump through all of these hoops, and there's so much paperwork and so many deadlines you have to make, and I understand accountability, but when it comes down to lives, if it's a pilot program, get it up and running and make sure that each individual agency, because they're working with all the public housing agencies to implement the program, make sure that there's accountability within, but at least get it started if it's lives involved.
Thanks, Amy. Speaking of lives, you know, the very lives of people being involved, you know, one of the things about policy that fascinated me in school was the development of a public policy and social welfare legislation over time. And, you know, as a social work student, I'm sure you've been exposed to the history of public welfare law, and just a couple of things I want to highlight here before I have a question for you. In England, which obviously was where much of American public policy and political culture came from, in England, the Poor Law Reform Act of 1834 was enacted, and what it did basically was abolish all aid to able-bodied poor people. All right. And, you know, that's relevant for a number of reasons, because we're seeing those same kind of things happening in the United States today again. And, you know, that Poor Law Reform Act of 1834 was based largely around the values of the day. And we talked about it at the top of the show, and how policy is really the embodiment of values of a society. And Thomas Malthus was pretty much a founder of the modern population theory. And Malthus thought that the poor people should be considered expendable. And, you know, he agreed that social welfare programs should be terminated so poor people basically wouldn't be able to propagate, wouldn't be able to, in other words, so that they would just die. And, you know, the phrase is decrease the surplus population, right? That was actually the language of the
population
day.
Population control.
Yeah, population control. You know, and it goes back to that individualistic value that, you know, the poor people are just basically responsible for their own plight. And then we see out of that legislation and that kind of thinking, we see the growth of these private charities, and that's where we are today in this country. All these, you know, these private charities kind of pick up the slack where the government apparatus refuses to help folks who need assistance. So I guess what I want to ask you, in light of all of that, historically, and in light of the situation that we're in this country, which is very much the same, where the powers that be in particular and Americans in general tend to see certain populations of people as totally expendable, such as poor people, people of color, you know, immigrants, you know, and obviously in order to perpetrate, you know, these wars that the federal government perpetrates around the world, you know, there's a level at which we're told that those people are expendable, that somehow they're less valuable as human beings than we are. You know, Iraqis are less valuable, or Muslims, or Arabs, or, you know, fill in the blank, depending upon who the federal government's going after. But let me ask you this, you know, as a social worker and looking at your ability to impact the lives of people and families, and also your ability to impact policy, what would you do to change that culture, you know, that climate, that belief system in this country, that certain populations of people are expendable? You know, I mean, because we look at we look at the prison system, and it's overflowing with African American males, and the fastest growing prison population in the country is black females. So, you know, obviously this belief that there are certain people who deserve their fate, that they're expendable, that the best thing that we can do is just let them die off so that we can move on. What would you do to change that culture and that climate?
If the power was afforded to me, I believe that there should be more programs to help enrich and expand the lives and minds of not just our youth, but in people who are poor in general. There needs to be some type of program, something that will address the mental health needs, because a lot of it has to do with mental health. No one's looking at the mental and physical health of poor people. And I believe that if you can inspire a generation to stand up, where are the Martin Luther Kings? Where are the Malcolm X's? Where are the Marcus Garveys? Where are the people who stand up and speak out? And really, that's all I think that needs to be done, is to have more voice. And a lot of people are just going through their daily lives, say here in public housing, there's a fear of speaking out. You know, maybe you'll lose your place, or if you're working at a job, maybe you'll lose your spot because of office politics. Like, I'm very vocal myself. Not only do I live in the housing authority and I work within the housing authority, but things that I see, I speak up on, and I've basically been hushed many times. I've been told I might be right with what I say, but don't step on a roach. I believe that people need to be inspired more. We need more leaders. We need more people who will stand up and affect and infect somebody else to stand up and speak out too. Because there's, in the numbers, take with Barack Obama being elected. I didn't vote for him, but at the same time, people stood up and they got involved. They voted for him, and he's in office. And we just need more of that, people to stand up and become involved. And that's easier said than done, and it's not black and white as opposed to what would I do. But we just need more people who have the gumption to stand up to infect a generation or a community that is close to them and set them afire so that they can do the same.
Right. And, you know, I'm glad you mentioned that. I didn't vote for Barack Obama either. That makes two of us. Or Peter, that makes three of us. I voted for Senator McKinney, which is a problem that, you know, most black people in this country had no idea that there was a black woman who had, you know, served 12 years in Congress that was one of the most outspoken voices in Congress when she was there, if not the most outspoken voice against, you know, the Bush regime, and had no idea that she was running with a third party, you know, in that past election. I'm glad you mentioned that. But the point I want to allude to is what you spoke of, you know, the Malcolms, the Martins, the Marcus Garveys, and we can go on with the Ida B. Wellses and the Fannie Lou Hamers, that people, more children, more people need to be inspired in general by these individuals. Well, when you look at it, it's a systematic thing. I'm willing to bet that you didn't learn about any of these individuals in school. I'm willing to bet, and you know, with the exception of maybe, you know, Martin Luther King, and you probably got the watered down version of Martin Luther King, but I'm willing to bet that you didn't learn about any of these individuals in school. So my question is what have you seen, your experience, you know, going through public school, what have you seen? You know, what are some of the issues? Because, you know, oftentimes these issues that we see in terms of Peter mentioned the prison industrial complex, and so many you know, black men and black women are incarcerated today in 2011, and we only represent 13% of the overall population, but, you know, black men represent almost 50% of the entire prison population. And just didn't start there. I mean, this process has been set in place a long, long time ago, where youth, you know, in some states, you know, they take the aggregate number of youth that are reading below grade level, and instead of, you know, spending the money to get them to grade level, they spend the money to build juvenile detention centers and prisons, because, you know, one of the top indicators of someone's going to get incarcerated is obviously illiteracy rates. And, you know, so this path starts, there's a phrase out there, it's called the school to prison pipeline, and that starts a long, you know, then that starts, you know, unfortunately, in most brown and black skin, you know, schools or communities that are predominantly brown and black, you know, where those schools are situated. My question is to you, what are some of the issues you've seen going through, you know, the public school system that you went through? And the other part is, like, in reference to those individuals that you mentioned, you know, because I'm almost sure that you didn't learn about them in their entire gravity in school. To me, I see it as something systematic, that the reason why more youth, regardless of their skin color, their culture, because I think that everybody, you know what I'm saying, you know, could benefit from learning from the likes of Marcus Garvey and Malcolm X and Ida B. Wells, and I can go on and on and on. But I see it as something systematic, Amy. I see it as something, the reason why we don't get these individuals in school is because of the inspiring nature, because of the fact that these individuals resisted oppression. They resisted a oppressive system, a hegemony, and they embraced everything about themselves and their culture. And in spite of all of that, they continued to reach into their communities to try to galvanize and mobilize and affect, and as you said, infect in a positive way as many people in those communities as possible. And as you know, if more black youth knew of the legacy of these individuals, the true brevity of these individuals, without a doubt, there would be a catch-all of scores and legions of these youth that, you know, in your words, would be inspired, and would be those voices that you speak of. And without a doubt, you are one of those voices. You know, without a doubt, you are one of those voices. Those ancestors are working through you right now. The Stanley Hamers, the, you know, Ida B. Wellses, Claudia Joneses, you know, they are within you right now. But so it was kind of like a long-winded kind of question, but you know, I just wanted to ask you about, you know, the public school system and how that has been set up to systematically affect folks from not being inspired in the kind of way that you spoke of, that you are speaking of. Am I right?
Correct. One thing, the powers that be that sought and achieved, in some cases, to quiet those activist voices, those same powers that be are operating in the same way now. So it will behoove them to squash it or cover it or swallow it or whitewash it or only give the bare minimum of information, because they don't want to inspire change. They don't want to inspire new change makers because it doesn't benefit them. As far as the school system is concerned, the school system does not advocate smart children, I believe. You're in a grade, as I was, and they labeled me a problem child. They labeled my daughter a problem child because we were finished with our work. And, of course, you're bored, and so you're disrupting the class because you're talking. So they label a child like that a problem child when really they're just a cut above the work that you just gave them. Give them something else. You don't necessarily have to push them forward into an environment where they're not comfortable, but at least attend to the needs that they have then. My husband, who I said was diagnosed MMR, I asked him, what did he do in school? And he said they colored, they finger painted, they had pizza parties, and watched movies and took naps. And I said, up until what grade? He said until he dropped out, and that was the special education class. So
right.
They don't address the needs. The school system just does not address the needs of the youth. I personally am an advocate for uniforms. Because of how the culture affects our ability to focus. I believe, as students. If everyone has on the same thing, no one's worried about the fact that they do or they don't have whatever it is that they have. And as far as our leaders, like I said, they were quieted to some degree by being killed or being defamed. And a lot of people don't want to go through the hardships of that uphill battle.
Right. And I want to ask you a question. I want to make a segue to your story. It's one that is without a doubt inspiring. It inspired me. It inspired, you know, a couple of my colleagues that heard you speak as well. And these were people that are seasoned, you know, veterans that have been, you know, working in everything from higher education to social work for you know, some, you know, a few years to, you know, the other individual, the guy, you know, he had been in a working professional for, you know, 3 decades. And your story and your words and your passion inspire them as it did me, as it continues to do me. My question is to you. I want you to talk about your book. Can you tell us the title of your book that you're working on, the literary work that you're working on, and what that book is all about, what it approaches, what it covers, what it discusses, and when do you anticipate yourself being completed with that work?
I anticipate the completion the end of spring of this year. As far as that book is concerned, it is going to chronicle my life from before my beginning. I go into detail concerning my family life and the dysfunction that I had, and also into my drug abuse and prostitution and legal aspects of my life, and also how and what brought me out of the situations that I was in, and what has caused me or infected me in such a way that now I am an honor student and I am very involved not only in the community, but also at school, and that my passion is people, and that my passion is to be that voice that says, I know what you're going through. So basically that's what it is, from the guttermost to the uttermost, and I suspect that when I get through, of course I haven't arrived, so there will be a volume 2 as well that will just follow me from just my very humble and humble beginnings, and also my many downfalls into where I'm going.
Right.
You know, that's that in itself is inspiring, Amy. And due to time, I think we're winding down as far as our questions. This may be the last one I'm able to offer tonight, but before I do that, I just want to tell you that you are inspiring. You've been inspiring to me, and I know you are going to be inspiring to those folks who listen to our show. And I know you're going to be an inspiring social worker when you get out there. And so I want to wish you the best when you are out there in the field doing what you do. And my last question really is ties into, you know, your book, and the title of your book is very provocative, you know, from the guttermost to the uttermost. And you know, I know that many social workers work with folks who are languishing in that world of the guttermost, and it's an everyday challenge. You know, to go to work in those conditions and to work with folks who are hindered by so many social obstacles and been hindered by society to overcome so much the kind of things that you have overcome yourself. And so I guess I want to ask, you know, just in broad terms, as you go out as a social work professional, at whatever level it might be, in whatever area of social work it might be, How would you like to see your legacy if you look back in terms of what kind of uttermost? All right, if we could look at what the uttermost would be for the lives of the people and the families and the communities that you're going to have a chance to impact, and what kind of uttermost world or community or society would you like to see happen? Would you like to be part of creating? You know, and and how can we all go about doing that? You know, what's the roles that we have to play in making that uttermost a reality? And to go back and to use some of the language of another inspirational personality that we just honored the other night, Martin Luther King. He talked about it in terms of a beloved community, and so he started to paint a picture of what that might be like. So talk to us a little bit about what the uttermost means for you in a broader sense.
In a broader sense, the uttermost is a dissolving of isolation and alienation. We isolate ourselves. We're self-involved. I would like to see people overcome alienation. You know, if they're in the gutter, most likely they're alienated from something. But to overcome that to the point where they can interact with other people, we need a broader sense of community. We need people who are not just out for themselves. To me, that is the uttermost. The uttermost is each one teach one. The uttermost is one stepping down to hold their hand out to someone that is less fortunate to them. And that's what I would like for my life to embody. I want to use the arts. I want to use gifts and talents. A lot of people don't even know their own talent or what it is that is special only to them or that they do best, and use that as a therapy for themselves, a therapy for others. The uttermost to me would be the ultimate community. Of course, we all have our private lives, but what about community gardens? What about workshops? What about youth groups? That to me would be the uttermost, just for me to be more involved. I am still battling some of the gutter mentality that I grew up with. I'm still fighting it to this day. But to be able to shed some light to somebody else, to not get into position and then forget where I came from.
Right. Wow. Thank you. Thank you so much for calling in and spending, some quality time with us this past hour. It's been, powerful. I knew it was going to be powerful going in, but, an hour later, it continues to exceed my expectations. And as Peter said, you're always welcome on our radio program, to talk about any issues that may come up within your community. And definitely when that book gets published, before you start doing your book tour, we would like to have one of those first interviews and have you on the program to talk about the completion of your book, because without a doubt, I know you're going to complete it. And I look forward to supporting the publishing of your book in any way, shape, form, or fashion. I can, any shape, form, or fashion. Peter can, because, that, as you said before, it's about community. If we're not going to support one another, then, what the heck do we have various, resources that we have achieved, whether it's a few or many. It's about, Ubuntu, I am because you are. So I want to thank you again for coming on the program.
Yeah,
thank you very much for having me.
Thank you. All right, take care.
Thank you.
Well, that was a great interview, and we can talk about that on the other end. We're going to have a musical interlude. Once again, I got some new music from Sheepy just actually today, this morning. Got a fresh new track from my man Sheepy from Kirsten, Norway, and no, I'm not getting paid for playing his music. It's just good. I like it. So I'm going to play this song called Therapy, where he actually, I think it's appropriate, this is about his life story, and he put it on a, put on this this track right here. This is his life story that Sheepy has been through. It's his real life story, not made up. And he sent it to me, and I said, hey, you know, this is actually befitting, because you know we're doing a program that touches on, you know, believing in oneself and gaining that kind of internal drive. But you know, we need to be there for one another. So I'm going to play this song by Sheepy, and we'll we'll deconstruct some other things on other issues, as Peter said, you know. So your world news will continue to move on. We'll see you on the other end. This is Sheepy with Therapy.
SHEEPY,
yeah.
From the heart shit. Therapy music, man.
Feel me?
Let me clear my chest for a minute. Let's go. Yo, my father used a needle and heroin to escape the pain. And I remember every fucking time he stuck it in his vein. I knew I had to change the way that I was living. I was ruthless, careless, and not forgiving. I was surrounded by dope fiends, death and crime. And all that shit was like a tumor pressing in my mind. I had a demon that was tearing me apart inside. Manic depression, it was hard just to stay alive. Hard to wake up in the morning and put on a smile. To see ordinary people go on with their lives. I was smoking hash every day with the devilish eyes. Strung out trying to catch sleep when the sun rises. Popping pills, drinking alcohol on the side. I was fucked up and my mama used to cry. I had to make it through the stormy weather or become a lost soul in hell, trapped forever. I write emotions in a letter about every time I drank and hope for something better. Thinking I was clever, but dumb as fuck. A young man with an attitude like, yeah, what's up? I was lost in the madness and torn up inside when I heard the news about how Pop's gonna die. Now tell me, huh? Do you feel me? Do you understand? Do you believe me? Was a mess. I was nervous, restless, and shaking from the stress. A bloody mess like the blade on a butcher's knife. My life in pieces, you can cut a slice. Fought many fights and got knocked more than once. But I'm no pussy, yeah, I can take a punch. I hang around with a violent bunch who will stomp on your face and say, I wanna hear that crunch. My conscience was slowly slipping away. I had to live with myself every goddamn day. Shit stayed the same, man, I had to make a change. Living like this, with nothing to gain. End up like my pops with the needle in the vein. And make my future children feel the same pain. So, I had to make it through the stormy weather or become a lost soul in hell, trapped forever. Now tell me, do you feel me? Do you understand? Do you believe? Every part of me, see my father's grave and find truth in honesty. And honestly, I can say that I've been there. And honestly, I can say that I felt fair. It's like, it don't matter at all. Cause I always hit the ground whenever I fall. Still, my love is for all. My love is a fire ring. My love is pure. And sometimes a violent thing. And I'm still around, still here. Thanks to all of the people that you care. I can't breathe air on this fucking earth, and I can tell when you're fragile, like you are hurt. You can call me an asshole for what it's worth. You can call me filthy, like I'm dirty. Anyways, I made it through the stormy weather. I am not a lost soul in hell, trapped forever. Now tell me, do you feel me? Do you understand? Do you believe me? If you wanna speak, then speak freely. And if you wanna see me, then fucking come see me.
always make a change, regardless of what obstacles that might be in your path, and whatever you go through in your life, keep your head up. No matter what, if you believe in yourself, you will succeed.
Yeah, that was CP with Therapy. And we're gonna hit the ground running. We just had a powerful interview with Sister Amy, and something, Peter, that you and I were talking about off air. We actually ended the show. We were talking. We had the brother calling from the Virginia Island, Virgin Islands, and we were talking about. Well, he was talking about some of the issues on the ground there, in terms of how, you know, that island and the people there are systematically continue to be the very final beneficiaries, if at all, of their natural resources, and how his island is, island nation is continually being robbed and plundered through one-sided U.S. tourism. And then we started to talk about Haiti. A new story, it blew my mind. It blew my mind like 2 or 3 days ago when Baby Doc, the other half, the son version of the father-son team that was put in place, that it was put in place in 1956, I believe, 1957, with the help of the U.S. government, propped up, continually propped up, and put in place and supported by the likes of Reagan. Why? Because, you know, he and his son represented a anti-communist state in the Caribbean to kind of be a so-called countervailing force to the communist nation of Cuba and what that revolution, the Cuban Revolution, represented for oppressed people, not just there but throughout the world. And so this guy who, through the Tonton Macoutes, which was you know, this just brutal death squad police force that Papa Doc and Baby Doc unleashed on the people, killing tens of thousands of people, raping, torturing, mutilating tens of thousands of people, supported by the U.S., continually supported by the U.S. And this guy comes back. This guy, it's said that he extorted, close to $1 billion from his own country, and just walks back in. And some question marks. Peter and I were talking about this off here, when it first happened. And it blew both of our minds, and we're like, this doesn't happen without U.S. support. This doesn't happen without U.S. support. But at the same time, the democratically elected Jean-Bertrand Aristide still is in exile in Azania, South Africa. He's still in South Africa, and we know the likes of Condoleezza Rice, when she was Secretary of State, would not allow his return. So it's just interesting, the U.S. government preventing the return, not to U.S. shores, but to Haitian shores, to Haitian borders, but the U.S. saying, you can't come back to your own country. We're gonna control that. We're gonna dictate that. So we're gonna talk about that. We're gonna spend some time talking about that right after this.
When mass murderer and mega thief Jean-Claude Baby Doc Duvalier dares to return to the scene of his and his father's crimes without expectation of immediate imprisonment or worse, then we know that the rule of law has been utterly destroyed by the foreign occupiers of Haiti. From 1957 to 1986, the Duvaliers terrorized the Haitian population, killing or disappearing tens of thousands. Baby Doc is believed to have stolen nearly $1 billion from his homeland before the Americans airlifted him to extravagant exile in France 25 years ago. he would not have had the nerve to return if he did not think it was all right with the United States, the real overlord in Haiti. Haiti's poor excuse for a president, René Préval, must also think Baby Doc is under United States protection. Préval had vowed to arrest Duvalier if he ever made good on his threat to return, but state prosecutors could only summon the courage to pay a polite visit to Duvalier at his hotel in Port-au-Prince. Later, they accompanied him briefly to a government office and then escorted him back to his hotel. No handcuffs were ever in evidence. This is what happens when a nation's sovereignty is stolen. The lowest criminals on earth can simply fly into Haiti and book a hotel room, but the local authorities fear to do anything until the United States speaks to the issue. In Haiti, Washington's word is law. The Préval regime is helpless to seize the criminal, Duvalier, thief of the nation's treasury and executioner of its sons and daughters, unless the United States gives its permission. Observers with a sense of legal decorum and decency wonder how the Americans will turn Duvalier's visit to their advantage somehow. If they have Duvalier ejected from Haiti, then Washington can pretend to be an even-handed overlord who keeps out former dictators as well as the democratically elected president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, whom they booted out in 2004. The Americans are so morally bankrupt they may actually believe there is moral equivalence in keeping both Aristide and Duvalier out of the country. But then, of course, if Aristide had shown up unannounced, he would never have made it out of the airport without being put under arrest. Whether the Americans realize it or not, or even care or not, Duvalier's arrival cannot help but accentuate the imperial nature of U.S. policy towards Haiti. If there is one living man on earth that vast majorities of Haitians want imprisoned or dead, it is Baby Doc. If he is allowed to leave, a free man, or, in the craziest of all worlds, remain in Haiti as a free man, the world will assume that is Washington's choosing. Meanwhile, the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti and an international lawyers association are demanding that the Haitian government comply with Haitian law and arrest ex-president Jean-Claude Duvalier. They insist Duvalier is not protected by any statute of limitations because his offenses are crimes against humanity. It will be interesting to see how the American bosses wiggle their way out of this one, but then they've already shown that they can steal a whole country in the full light of day and call it legal. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
So, Peter, isn't that amazing? Well, I mean, not I said it cynically, but maybe, you know, amazing to some folks you know, head has been in the sand for a long time, but how the U.S. can dictate who can and cannot come into the country. Don't know what your thoughts are on that, Peter.
Yeah, it's scandalous at the very least. The fact how come Aristide is not in Haiti? Let's just ask that question. Why is he not there? When was he removed? How was he removed? It was the United States government that removed their democratically elected president from the country. Glenn spelled it right out. It said these events accentuate the imperial nature of what? U.S. policy. All right. You know, and this is kind of a theme for our show apparently. That policy, is important. You know, and in this case, foreign policy on an international level is just as important, and in many ways more so important than, you know, some of the domestic and local policies that we've been talking about earlier in terms of social work and things like that. But now we're looking at policy on a global scale, on the geopolitical chessboard, so to speak, and how the United States is a dominating and imperialistic hegemon you know, just a bully, just a global bully, really, to put it in the simple language. The United States government is just a global bully and uses the full force of its bloated military to bully other countries. And, you know, we see, as Glenn was mentioning, you know, a sovereign nation, or at least in theory, a sovereign nation like Haiti, was hesitant to even act before, you know, it got approval from the United States government, you know, its puppeteers in the U.S. government, which is utterly shameful. Utterly shameful and disgraceful, you know, to see the warped relationship between the Haitian government and the United States government in terms of a criminal. You know, I mean, Baby Doc is a criminal. I mean, in anybody's book, Baby Doc Duvalier is a criminal and should be behind bars. And if I'm not mistaken, he has since been arrested. Am I right on that, Solomon? He was arrested today, perhaps. Irregardless, you know, he is criminal, and you know, he should have been. Why was he not in prison the last 25 years instead of, you know, lounging, in freedom, you know, in relative luxury, in exile? You know, I mean, the fact that he wasn't in prison, and you know, and we can point to the fact that there are other criminals, global criminals, individuals who have perpetrated heinous crimes against humanity, much, much more egregious than those of Baby Doc Duvalier or his father, that are still walking around free men. And I'm talking about George Bush Sr., talking about George Bush Jr., talking about Dick Cheney, talking about Donald Rumsfeld, you know, and the list of those criminals is a long one. The fact that they are not only free men, but celebrities. And millionaires and power brokers amongst the elite political machinery of global capitalism, that in itself is criminal. You know, and right. So we look at the nature of U.S. policy, and we see really what it's all about. You know, it is about right. The rich getting richer and the poor getting fucked. And yeah. You know, the circus with the election in Haiti and then Baby Doc Duvalier returning, you know, are really just slaps in the face, are just more slaps in the face by U.S. imperialism, not only to Haiti, but to all of us who stand in solidarity with the Haitian people and with poor and oppressed people everywhere. It's a slap in the face. It's the U.S. government basically saying, "Fuck you, we're going to do what we want to do." And, you know, the hell with you if you don't like it. And these are just concrete evidences. You know, these are concrete evidences, you know, explicit actions of individuals and governments that we can point to and say, this is what the U.S. government is really all about. You know, all this high-minded rhetoric about the United States being about freedom and liberty and democracy, well, it's just that. It's rhetoric. It's talk. It's meaningless, you know. But what the United States is all about is conquest and imperialism, which ends up being death and destruction for the majority of people on the planet.
Right, he actually wasn't arrested technically. He was so-called detained. There were no restraints put on him. He was, you know, led to the police department or headquarters and was, we don't know what questions were asked of him. You know, it made its way out that, that he stated that he wasn't there for political purposes, that he was there to help with the humanitarian situation towards, involving the cholera and the aftermath of the earthquake and so forth. And, that's what, you know, so it's impending what his politically is going to happen, but it's just interesting. I mean, and Glenn Boer is right. I mean, Preval is a joke. He's a U.S. single
right.
fan. The U.S. they're going to control, they're going to play a very large role in terms of what happens or does not happen with Baby Doc, you know, seeing any justice, whatsoever. But it's just amazing. Yeah, and you're right. It's an effing joke, man. It is an effing joke because there can never be legitimate, never, ever be. I mean, there can never be legitimate elections or democracy in Haiti until Fanny Lavalas is able to participate. So right. Even without Aristide, his political party cannot even, and his political party was and is one of the most popular political parties in the country. It is the equivalent of saying, of some country saying to the U.S., say Romania, saying to the U.S., you cannot, you cannot allow the Democrats or you cannot allow the Republicans to participate
right.
in any more elections. That is literally the equivalent. And it's just, it's just amazing. I mean, and that is being controlled by Washington. The
mm-hmm.
fact that they cannot produce is being controlled by Washington. That's why Hillary Clinton kept her big, lying, stupid mouth shut, despite the fact that, you know, there are some members of Congress, you know, like Maxine Waters, that, wrote a letter to her in the State Department, you know, telling them not to honor the, to honor, recognize these recent sham elections because they have been a sham, and
mm-hmm.
And you know the State Department through spokesperson Crowley and others, said basically saying that they have no problem with these elections. They just they had this weak ass statement that they just want to see things move along as quickly as possible so that
mm-hmm.
the continued reconstruction can go along, and holding up or having another election is just gonna delay that. No, I think the fact that the U.S. government was holding up goods and things that were sent to Haiti post 2000 January 12, 2010, held out on tarmac, backed up on the tarmac. How they're I think that's something that prevents prevents people from starting to rebuild their lives, and I think that the fact that out of the $9 billion from donor countries that has been pledged, the fact that less than $2 billion has even made its way there thus far towards reconstruction, towards building housing, shelters, food, and all that stuff, is preventing that immensely. I mean, we're talking about over $7 billion that is supposed to be somewhere in Haiti going to work right now. That's simply not, So, it's a sham, man. It's a sham. It is a sham. And these people have been punished, Peter, have been punished since 1804 by the West and these European countries that, European-based countries such as France,
mm-hmm.
Canada, another Western country, not a European country. Well, basically, you can call America a European country, a Eurocentric country. They've been punished ever since they had the audacity to rebel. And, and we see this policy just slipping and just ripping the guts out of countries left and right. And which brings me to this clip. I think that I think is really apropos since we're on the track, really dissecting and taking a critical look at U.S. foreign. I mean, and before I go on, Peter, can you imagine if these kind of dialogues and analysis and discussions were being had on mainstream airwaves, throughout the country.
I can't imagine it. I can't imagine it because the corporate nature of the mainline media, they obviously don't make room for dissenting opinion. Anything that goes outside the bounds of the prescribed dialogue is just not going to be permitted. So the kind of questions that we're asking, the kind of analyses that we're given, the kind of analyses that we hear from Glenn Ford, corporate media just won't allow those to to be heard, and so it appears, it seems that the public discourse doesn't even include any kind of dissenting opinions, which of course is not the case. It's just that the corporate media just refuses to acknowledge, as much less, you know, broadcast any dissenting opinions, particularly those that would cast the United States government in a negative light.
Right, right, and with that, you know, I want to play this, man. This is this is angering and it's powerful to the core. We'll talk about this after the break.
On the day the federal government set aside to celebrate the life of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., the great man of peace, the New York Times featured an article on a major problem the United States is encountering in pursuing its endless high-tech wars. No, it's not money. The U.S. government spares no expense in financing the maintenance and expansion of American empire. And clearly, the Democratic congressional opposition to America's wars has collapsed, certainly since a Democrat took on the job of war maker in chief. The great obstacle to perfection of the American style of mass killing, it turns out, is information overload. It seems that U.S. troops in the field are getting so much information from so many different sources about targets for obliteration, they're having trouble figuring out who to kill. Assorted military experts told the Times that information overload is the reason the American military winds up massacring so many civilians in Afghanistan. All those smart bombs and automated unmanned airplanes and other brilliant gadgets are just, well, too smart for the soldiers to keep up with, inevitably, but not on purpose, of course, causing collateral damage to Afghan women, children, families, wedding parties, and other nuisances that clutter up the landscape of the country, getting in the way of the U.S. war machine. The Times story blames information overload for last February's drone attack that killed 23 Afghan civilians. There was plenty of information that showed there were children in a civilian convoy of vehicles that was preparing to leave a village, but American personnel, in their zeal to eliminate any potential threats to U.S. troops, disregarded that information and fired their missiles at the civilians. The Times compared the slaughter of innocents to a mistake by an office worker who, quote, loses track of an important email as his messages pile up. In this innocuous newspaper story on Martin Luther King Day, we see the full scope of the moral rot that has consumed the U.S. military, the New York Times, and American society as a whole. To the Americans, the Afghan civilians were not victims of an occupying foreign war machine that treated them like roaches to be stamped upon in their own homeland. No, they were the equivalent of mislaid email. The Americans were not engaged in crimes against humanity, against peace, and against the right of all peoples to be sovereign in their own countries. No, it was the Americans who were the victims of too much information. This was not a mass murder of 23 people attempting to go about their lives in their own neighborhood. No, it was a technical problem that is most notable for the difficulties posed to the American war effort by an excess of information. What Dr. King would say were he to read the abominable excuse for murder published by the New York Times is that the United States is suffering not from an information overload, but an overload of depravity, a barbaric indifference to human suffering. Lost Afghan lives are not the equivalent of lost emails, and any society that thinks that way is a moral vacuum whose denizens have lost their souls. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
Peter, that goes to what you were talking about earlier in terms of what the U.S., how the U.S. values life outside of you, especially life of color.
Right.
Non-Christian, non-white life outside of the U.S. borders.
Yeah, it does. It points directly to that, and you know, it's a, yeah. I mean, where do you start with this? How do you start to unpack, you know, the madness of that kind of thinking? You know, just the outright lie, the fabrication, you know, that this obstacle that the military faces is information overload. You know, what that does is it glosses over entirely the fact that they were illegal wars and they were illegal occupations in the first place. You know, that they violated international law, they went against the United Nations, that literally tens of millions of people all around the globe marched in opposition to the launching of these wars. You know, it just brushes all that aside, and you know, it takes, in other words, it makes it normative. It says, well, it's normal. We don't even question their presence there anymore. You know, like Glenn was saying, you know, it doesn't call into question the fact that the United States military is there in the first place, because that is the narrative or the mythology that the government has put over on the American citizenry. Is that it's the United States' natural right. It's like a birthright for the U.S. military, you know, to invade and occupy any damn country that it wants to. And so it's beyond question even that the U.S. military has a right, like its God-given right, to be in Iraq, to be in Afghanistan, to bomb Pakistan and Yemen and occupy Haiti and have military bases all across the globe. Those things are not even open to question anymore. You know, like I mentioned before the clip, you don't hear dissenting voices or dissenting opinions on these issues because they're beyond question anymore. It's like something that we don't even question that. Now the spin machine, instead of questioning the very presence of the U.S. military in these countries, is simply coming up with lame excuses as to why a so-called collateral damage exists, why these innocent civilians are being snuffed out on a regular basis, and to come up with some lame excuse like information overload. Not only is that a slap in the face to the American public as if we're total idiots, but it's a slap in the face to the Afghans and the Iraqis and the other victims of American militarism. That, oh, well, sorry, we just killed hundreds of thousands of your citizens, but it was a mistake, my bad. You know, we had too much information, or we had bad info, we had bad intelligence. You know, like that's a rational excuse, Solomon. I mean, you know, and you know, Glenn is right. It points to the moral rot, just the utter bankruptcy of American morality when they come up with excuses for mass murder. And then the other thing that's reprehensible about that is it makes the military the victims.
Right.
Oh, well, you know, these poor soldiers, you know, they had too much information to deal with. They had bad intelligence that they couldn't sort out. You know, we're supposed to feel bad for them? I don't think so. You know, I don't think so. You know, over a million Iraqis and Afghanistans have been murdered. Over a million have been, you know, either internally or externally displaced within their country or without their country. You know, and we're supposed to feel bad for the soldiers because they have too much information. What a crock! I mean, you talk about just morally bankrupt and utterly reprehensible, and to use a more metaphysical term, just outright evil. You know, that's what that is. That's what that is. You know, trying to justify and rationalize the indiscriminate killing of innocent people is utterly reprehensible. It's grotesque. And that is a true perversion. You know, we're seeing, you know, it's, you know what it is? It's pornography. You know, it's pornography. It's militaristic pornography. You know, because it's utterly obscene and grotesque.
Yeah. It sure is. And I mean, what's even more sick is it goes into the whole pathology of American society, because that as you said, that grotesque, militaristic, you know, bestiality. You know what I'm saying? You can't even call it pornography. I mean, it's just too kind of, I mean, it's like, you know, it's something that should be looked at like bestiality. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, humans are just not supposed to be having sex with, you know, with four-legged animals. You know, they're just, they're not supposed to. That's, you know, that's, not natural. That's not supposed to, you know, not supposed to occur. And so this, you know, should be looked at as something that's not natural for
right.
a human
right.
being to look at the to look at to value, you know, military items and emails and electronics, more than they do actual lives
yes.
of human beings. And
right.
to put the lives of those human beings, the lives of those human beings that will never see the light of day again, that will never see the light of day again. Some of those lives can not even be recovered, because we have to understand it's not always cute when a bomb goes off. Sometimes a bomb detonates and when a missile drops, sometimes it's not just, you know, the body is parts are not always intact. You know, the person could be split into a million pieces, and completely desecrated. You know, family doesn't even have the chance to even have a proper burial. But that should be looked at as bestiality. But the pathology in this country, the way U.S. citizens, the way far too many U.S. citizens. Far too many citizens, masses and masses of U.S. citizens, see these things as if it's nothing, Peter. As
right.
if it's ho-hum, nothing. Can you imagine? And we said it before. We said it before. It was completely wrong. What, you know what I'm saying? When you have the loss of life taken unnecessarily by the brutal acts of an individual or individuals, as we saw you know, 2 hours away from where you live in Arizona. But, and we saw an entire nation mourning. We saw, and yes, it was American citizens. So some people say, yeah, well, you know, they were mourning the loss of American citizens. And that's why there was emphasis, and that's why there was a national press coverage of the president's speech at this memorial that was done. But I say, you know, that's an easy debate to handle, because I say, well, okay. No. It's not tantamount. No, it is not. That is not the reason why we mourn those folks and don't mourn folks in Afghanistan. No, that is not the reason. Because every time an American citizen perishes unnecessarily, the nation does not grieve as one, Peter, and you know that. You know, the nation does not grieve as one, Peter, because when we see black men and brown-skinned men perish, when we see black people in general perish unnecessarily at the hands of state-sponsored, you know, just, you know, G.I. Joe, you know, just gung-ho, power-hungry, and in some cases just racially motivated police that go in there and just buck shots and take lives, as we saw with Oscar Grant. We didn't see the nation grieve with Oscar Grant. He was unarmed. This was a father whose child no longer has a father. His father is deceased. His father was taken by a 6'6" white, gung-ho, evil police officer and was taken and shot execution style, face down, ground in the pavement. Did we see the masses of Americans mourn his life? No, we did not. Why, Peter? Because when it ultimately comes down to it, the president of the United States of America, whether it's Barack Obama or whoever, is going to give the benefit of the doubt to their military apparatus. And, yes, the police are like a military apparatus. They are trained like a military apparatus. We see more and more soldiers coming back and finding their – more and more soldiers that were just bucking off shots and just crazed, trigger-happy, you know, soldiers in Iraq coming back and finding jobs as police officers throughout the U.S. We see former Blackwater employees finding themselves in police academies. And so the U.S. government takes the side. We'll take the side. And when I mean by take the side, I don't necessarily even mean them coming out and saying, oh, yeah, we support the killing, you know what I'm saying, this, that, and the other. But silence, silence is what is golden. Silence is what allows the oppression to become standard, a standard way of life. Silence in the face of injustice allows the killing, the illegal, unwarranted killing of a black man by the police to be status quo, to be status quo, Peter. So when people say that, when people say, oh, it's because American citizens, no, because we don't even mourn American citizens in the same way. No, you know, Peter, why did we not look at Johan Metzelis, the police officer that killed Oscar Grant? Why didn't we look at this the same way as we look at that, you know, that crazy guy, you know what I'm saying? What's his name?
Lofner?
The guy. Huh?
Lofner?
Exactly. The gunman in Arizona. I don't know, I just slipped my mind. But you see his exactly. You see his bald head, and you see that his mugshot, the big eyes, and he looks like a friggin' serial killer. Pathological serial killer, and they flash it there, and this thing, you know, so you see the face. Why weren't the killers of Sean Bell that shot 49, 50 bullets into him and injured his comrades that were celebrating their, you know, his upcoming his marriage that was going to happen in 12, 16 hours. You know, why wasn't there those police officers flashed there like the pathological killers that they were? Why weren't they flashed all over the place, Peter? Why, you know what I'm saying? Why weren't these young men mourned? Why wasn't Ayanna Stanley Jones? Why wasn't a 7-year-old black girl, why wasn't she mourned by the nation? Why, let's get to the root of it, Peter. Let's get to the root of it. People that are listening, let's get to the root of it. Let's stop ignoring the 800-pound gorilla in the room or the 2-ton elephant that's sitting right next to you. Let's not ignore it anymore. Could it be that it's race-based? Could it be because they were black-skinned and brown-skinned? Could it be that? Could it be that and that they were killed by an arm of the government, a state-sponsored arm of the government? Could it be that? I think that it is that, and I think that I would challenge any debate on any national scene, you know, anyone that would want to refute that. I would challenge any of that because you can't tell me, say, oh, that's why they were celebrated. That, I mean, that's why they were mourned. And yes, they should be mourned. That little girl, the 9-year-old girl, yes, they should be mourned. Their lives were taken from them. But so were these individuals I just mentioned. So was this 7-year-old girl. This 7-year-old girl's life was no less than a 9-year-old girl that was born on 9/11 that was ruthlessly murdered by that psychopath. Her life is no less than that. But we didn't have any national mourning. We didn't have any national mourning for any of them. So people don't give me this crap that we don't mourn the Afghani civilians that have been killed by drones and air raids and ground raids, you know, by U.S. military forces, and just ho-hum, oh, well, it's just collateral damage. Don't tell me that they're not being mourned here because they're not American citizens. No, it's because our society here has lost its way, and has become pathologically apathetic and especially pathologically apathetic and desensitized when it comes to brown and black skin and people that have pigment and people that are non-Christian, people that happen to be Muslims, when their lives are taken and they happen to be innocent civilians. That's why we don't celebrate. That's why we don't mourn their deaths. That's why we don't mourn the loss of life, because this is the human race that we're all part of. So truthfully, when something happens unnecessarily, we, you know what I'm saying, where someone loses their life, especially when it's at the hands of our own taxpayer-financed military, if we were really in touch with our humanity, Peter Fowler, if we were really in touch with our humanity, Mr. Fowler, then we would view these individuals, we would view these people and mourn them the same way that we mourn white civilian citizens that had their lives ripped away from them by violence, by state-sponsored violence, or by some pathological nut, as we saw in Arizona, acting on his own. We would mourn these individuals, you know, the same way. But, Peter, we don't.
No, we don't, and it points to the reality of the pathology that you referred to a moment ago. You know, that one of the fundamental pathologies of Americanism is this compartmentalization of human beings into, you know, good human beings and bad human beings. And in this country, in our society, good human beings are represented basically and narrowly by white and Christian. And anyone who's outside of that is kind of lumped into this bad human being category. You know, and there's subtlety to it, and there's nuance to it. But broadly speaking, that's the caste system, or part of the caste system, that is Americanism, you know. And folks, you know, might want to say, well, we don't have a caste system or a class system in the United States. Well, nothing could be further from the truth. This is a deeply compartmentalized society. And on the far end of the spectrum are the, you know, invalued others, which are, you know, these people who are outside of the norm. You know, they're outside of whiteness, they're outside of Christianity, they're outside of Americanism. And today we see them in the faces of the people of Iraq, and the people of Afghanistan, the people of Haiti, and other people of color around the world. And those people are utterly expendable. And, you know, maybe that's not written down anywhere in any federal, you know, any it's not written in the Constitution. You know, that's the beloved document these days. It's in the Constitution, right? You know, it doesn't say that explicitly. But that's the way the government behaves, you know. So de facto caste system, and within the country, very clearly, you know, people of color are on the bottom, you know. And you look at the prison system just for evidence of that, and you know, it's just the reality of Americanism today that certain people are expendable, certain people are not valuable where others are. You know, you don't see. I mean, look at just. How about the what's that show? I don't even know if it's still on TV, but it's called The Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous. You know, rich people and famous people are revered and worshipped. You know, we're supposed to look up to those. When one of those people dies, oh, it makes headlines, right? It makes headlines. Right. It makes news. You know, so and so died, or when one of them gets pregnant or has a baby or names their kid, it's all over the damn news, like it's important.
Mm-hmm.
But when an Oscar Grant, you know, is murdered. Just murdered in cold blood, face down on the pavement, you know, by some guerrilla in a police uniform. You know, there's no notice taken, and there's no public outcry. There's no outrage outside of, you know, the local and the family uproar. You know, that's created, and it points to that pathology that you referred to. I remember several years ago when. The space shuttle blew up, and you know the mourning circus that followed, you know, as if those people were, you know, we were just supposed to be in deep mourning and just so sorrowful, so sad, you know. There was 7 of them or 11 of them, something like that. Oh, and they died, and you know, the whole country was cast into sackcloth and ashes. Well, you know why? Why? Yeah, it's unfortunate that they died, but, you know, they're no more important or didn't serve their country any better than, you know, firefighters who run into burning buildings every day, and doctors and nurses who heal people every day, and, you know, and are exposed to all kinds of nasty things every day. And, you know, I mean, you know, why do we have this separation between, you know, these people are more valuable or more worthy than other people? Well, because that's part of the value system that's ingrained in Americanism, is this caste system, you know, and there's gradations of human beings in terms of who's worthy and who is not. You know, one of my favorite examples in history of just how deranged and pathological the mind of the European is one of the early laws regarding race in this country. And I think it was with the state of Virginia. And originally, their laws were such that a child who had a black father was considered black. All right, that's how they determined who was black and who was white. Well, they changed that law after a while because so many slave masters were having sex with their female slaves, and they were bearing, you know, children. And so what they did was they switched it so that the mother, you know, so whoever was born to a black mother was a black child. And what that did, in effect, Solomon, it just shows you the depth of depravity of the white male and the white mind, is they were enslaving their own children. Simply by having a child by a slave female ensured that child was born into slavery. You know, that just shows you how depraved their mind is. I mean, that's beyond words. How depraved that is. You know, and you look at the every administration since the end of the Civil War was approached by civil rights groups and civil rights leaders to establish some kind of anti-lynching legislation, and every administration said no. Every administration, every presidential administration turned them down. It wasn't a priority to establish anti-lynching legislation when black folks were being lynched on a regular basis for an entire century following the Civil War. Apparently, that wasn't enough of a priority for the federal government to move to establish some laws for anti-lynching. I mean, what does that say? You know, what is the message sent there in terms of the value of human life when it's in brown skin? That says volume. That speaks volumes right there. So the pathology runs deep, Solomon. You know, you're right, and that's exactly what it is. It's a pathology. It's a sickness, and it plays out every day on the battlefields around the world, where the U.S. military guns down innocent people, and those of us back home, you know, we've been trained to think that, well, their lives really don't matter, you know, and then even here at home, you know, who's worthy, who's deserving of health care? Well, people with money are, and people without money, well, we don't deserve it. That's the way it is. I mean, nobody's come out and said it like that, but in practice and in fact, that's how it is. So some people are deserving and are worthy of health care and getting medication. Others are not. And it's just the simple fact of Americanism and the value system that is Americanism.
Right. And, you know, and you just mentioned health care, and you saw what happened today. I mean, it's probably unlikely that it's going to pass in the Senate because even if it did be a pass in the Senate, it's unlikely that it's a certainty that Obama would veto it, since it's his so-called healthcare reform bill. But today, this afternoon, the Congress voted to repeal the healthcare reform bill. This just happened today. They voted almost completely down political lines, but they voted to repeal it, and it was primarily led by the Republicans. But yeah, I mean if there was any, let's not let the Democrats off the hook either. These are the same Democrats that, you know, I mean, I would rather, like, if I'm going to get into a fight, I'm going to get into a fight, you know, that has to do with people's lives, with justice, because it is justice in terms of getting health care and not getting it. It's a human right. I mean, by the UN Charter, but I mean, I don't even need the UN Charter to tell me that it's a human right. And so if I'm going to, you know, tell my constituents, which is what many of the Democrats said, that we're going to fight for a single payer system, and then that gets whittled down to a public option, and then that gets whittled down to this piece of crap that was, you know, halfway written by healthcare lobbyists. You know, written by healthcare lobbyists. Are you kidding me? and you know, to this like piece of rubbish that's like thrown there. And so, like, you know, it's crazy. I mean, and so these Republicans are like friggin' a-holes. But you know, this is something that you know, a strong, vigorous fight for this. You know what I'm saying? Even if it's, you know, would have made a real stance, would have shown the people that, wow, you know what I'm saying, these Democrats, they've changed. You know what I'm saying? They fought tooth and nail for what they believed in. You know what I'm saying? And they got voted out, but they fought for single payer because they believed that we all deserve not affordable health care, but we all deserve health care, period. We all deserve quality health care, not with a price tag attached to it, but we all deserve health care, period. Single payer, financed by the government, financed, you know what I'm saying, financed by all of our tax dollars collectively, all right, you know what I'm saying, single payer. But they didn't. They didn't, Peter, because when it came down to it, that corporate money that came from Cigna and United and Blue Cross Blue Shield and the pharma companies, that is what made them back off even more and even more and even more. So they can try to blame it on the Republicans all they want, but they allowed those corporate dollars to get in there and to influence the way they vote. And it didn't just happen in 2009. It didn't just happen in 2000. It has been happening for decades. And it's just going to get worse, as we see with the Citizens United ruling.
Right.
It is a sickness. It is a sickness. And you mentioned poor people, but that is what they come up with, a method, Peter, that even separates poor people from other poor people. So you have poor white folks that truthfully should be in solidarity with other poor folks, regardless of their color. But they use that thing, man. They look differently than you. They worship different than you. They have different cultural mores than you. They're black. They're brown. They speak Spanish. They, you know what I'm saying? They're this. They're that. Oh, it's them. It's them. They're taken from us. Oh, it's them. It's that pregnant, so-called illegal alien that's in here. Oh, she came in here pregnant, and it's our tax dollars that are taken away from our health care because someone has to deliver that baby. Oh, that's what it is. Oh, it's those poor black folks on the other side of town, the shiftless black folks that are, you know, on welfare. They're taken away from such and such. And it works like a gym on these mental Lilliputians, man. It works like a gym. They can't see, they can't focus outside of skin color. They can't focus out of the racism that has poisoned their veins. Their myopic, limited sights are set purely on their own socially constructed race, their whiteness, their white privilege. You know what I'm saying? While at the same time, and the irony of it is, at the same time, they're getting pimped. They're getting pimped and screwed hard and raped by the same masters that they think are fighting on their behalf. What a sick pathology that we have in this society.
Yeah, it is. It's entirely pathological. And, you know, one of the angles on, you know, the Obama health reform issue is, you know, two comments on that. You know, it was demonstrated, you know, through polling that the majority of the American people were in favor of single payer health care for everyone. Okay, so first
Correct.
Of all, you know, both the Democrats and the Republicans, they're the same party. They're just different branches of the same party. They're the capitalist party. So you know, irregardless of the percentages of the makeup, Democrat, Republican, in the government, they were at fault, both of them collectively, for refusing to heed the wishes of the American people. And that's just at its core, it's anti-democratic. Okay, the will of the majority of the people was thwarted. All right, and you mentioned why it was thwarted. Obviously, for corporate interests, and the corporations won out. They, you know, big pharma and insurance companies, they basically wrote the reform legislation anyway. And so it was pretty much toothless. And so why would the Republicans be so hell-bent on repealing it when it really was toothless anyway? Well, primarily because of that pathology, Solomon. You know, the Republicans, and one of the leaders in the Republican, I think it was in the Senate, said that their number one priority was what? Make Obama a one-term president. Their number one priority wasn't to
Mitch
end,
McConnell.
Mitch McConnell. Their number one priority was not to end all these wars that's draining the economy and killing people all over the world. Their number one priority wasn't developing a world-class public education program. Their priority wasn't providing health care and well-being and all those good things. No, their number one priority was to get the black dude out of the White House. All right, and so this move to repeal the health care reform is really politically motivated by the racism that runs so deep in the Republican Party. And what this essentially is the Republicans' way of putting Obama in his place, right? Because that's another thing that runs deep in the racist history of this nation, is that, you know, when a black person gets out of place or gets uppity, he needs to get put in his place. And that's what the Republicans are doing. They're basically saying, you're not in charge here, we are. You know, this is our country, goddammit, and we've had enough. And that's what the whole point and purpose of the teabaggers, you know, is their revulsion to a black president and their refusal to live under the leadership of a black president. And so this, you know, this healthcare repeal issue has more to do with putting Obama in his place, and the deep racism of regressives in this country than it does about politics, as it does about health, you know, because those are really just side issues. You know, this is just a way for the racists to flex their muscles, you know, and say, we're in charge, you're not. You know, they've made that very clear. They've made that very clear.
Right. Yep. Yeah, I mean, you're right. And, you know, with the few moments we have left, I mean, it's Peter and I say it all the time, it's we got to wake up. Folks that are listening on this program right now, I mean, we've had, a tremendous 3 hours once again. I mean, having Sister Amy on, you know, tell her story and to give her insights and her vision and her goal and, you know, the humanity that she has within her to build a better system of social work, social services, that it, you know, saves lives and doesn't negate, people's lives. We've talked about, the continued just rape of the people of Haiti, of their humanity and their resources and preventing them from controlling their own destiny. You know, we've talked about, you know, U.S. militarism, but it ultimately comes to you and I, all of us, you know, myself, Peter, everyone that's listening live or on archive, it comes down to all of us. You have a choice, you know, something that the 5%ers, you know, which is the 5%ers say, often is that you have a choice. You either build or you destroy. You're on this planet. We're on this planet. We got a choice. Not everything is as complex as economics. Not everything is complex as nuclear physics. Some things are very, very simple, and we have a choice. You either build or you destroy. You either build or you destroy. And you can say, oh, well, it's not. Well, I didn't fire that bomb. I wasn't controlling that joystick from Nevada that was controlling that Predator drone that dropped 16 missiles on villages in North Waziristan. But your complicity and your silence will enable that to continue to go on. So you may not have known what we were talking about, but now we've outlaid it. So your complicity, if you do not take this link and send it off to your friends, or you do not even start, and even beyond that, if you do not start these conversations independently with your friends and your family, no matter how you know, right-winged or Americanized your family is, be that inconvenient hero. Raise that voice, because most of your family may not jive with you, but there might be one family member that says, oh, man, John, let me talk to you after. I didn't know that. Be that inconvenient. We have to take these conversations to the streets. We have to, but it starts in our households, our communities, but we got to take them to the streets. And that's the only way that we can politically mobilize folks to really push for humanity. So we got 30 seconds left, but you know, so I just want to, you know, thank you, Peter, once again for you know, giving your powerful insights on another great show. I'm glad to be flying this radical plane painted in red, black and green, you know, all the way to the sky. I'm glad to be flying those with you, and look forward to doing with you again. And everyone, look forward for you to tune in. This is Solomon and Peter Fowler for Your World News.
Peace out.